You dick.
What the fuck's in that glass? Looks like it. What is it?
It's a fruit smoothie.
Like that colour? Yes. You know those Soleros that you used to get?
Which ones?
Not the orange ones, but the red ones.
Do you not get those anymore?
I think they're known as red Soleros. They were well nice. It kind of looks like that. But if you froze it and put a stick in it, I'd probably lick it.
The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Happy holidays, everybody. 'Tis the season to be surprised. Especially you, Aries Abisko. I'm going to make you famous. Forget about filling up Shea Stadium, Bruno Sammartino. Forget about beating Nick Bockwinkel. Forget about all those things that you never stop telling anybody about. Because on the night of the 28th, your name is going to go down in infamy. And you know why? You will have handed the NWO Nitro, the show that almost single-handedly has changed the industry as you know it. It should have been ours from the very beginning. We got cheated out of it. Not this time. Not this time. Definitely not this time. See this foot? That one right there, Larry. Size 10. E. That's the foot that I'm going to put right alongside of your head, Zabisco. It's going to hit you right about there. It'll be the last thing that you feel. Now, maybe a little lower. Oh, you won't see it. I promise you. You won't see it, but you will feel it right about there. And it'll all be over. This one here, it's all about speed. This one hits hard, that fast. It's all about planning. You haven't planned very well, Larry. It's all about smarts. You haven't done your homework. It's all about training. This one. All of the things that you haven't done. Now put that one away. Don't need it. And you know what happens then? You get beat. You get embarrassed. You get humiliated. You're going to be humiliated. The man who lost Nitro. The man who had the opportunity to keep the taking over for the last year and a half. You alone had the opportunity to make it all go away. But you're going to blow it because you didn't do your homework. You underestimated your opponent. You, Larry Zbysko, are not a legend in your own time. You're not even a legend in your own mind. You're a legend in your own fantasy. I've got the entire NWO behind me. We've got our own referee, Bret Hart. J.J. Dillon, what were you thinking? What were you thinking? But I want to thank you. I really, really, really want to thank you. Because, Larry, this is going to be just too easy. This Monday night, a very special holiday treat for NWO fans around the world. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, because, after all, 'tis the season to be surprised, is it not?
The preceding announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hello and welcome to episode 83 of the New Generation Project podcast, brought to you by Milton Bradley's Karate Fighters, where we have well and truly left the heroes of Hulkamania in the dust, or more accurately Atlanta, and are knee-deep into the advent of Attitude. Today, we make one final trip over to WCW, where the big fellas play, to see how they pay off the storyline they've spent 18 months building, the long-awaited showdown between Hollywood Hulk Hogan and the icon Sting for the WCW World Heavyweight title. It's Starrcade 1997. My name is Stuart Brooks, and I'm joined today, as ever, by our very own big fella, Paul Scrivens.
Good morning.
And the Total Four package, Adam Wykes.
What? Hello.
Four-pack age.
Yeah, get it?
Yeah. But you wouldn't really drink a four-pack very often, would you?
A four-pack? Not often nowadays,
no. Because you're more crafty.
Yeah, I'm a bit more crafty these days.
So. They don't do craft ale in four-packs?
They do, but generally you'll buy 12 singulars.
That's it. Kind of like, I think when you have kind of, when you're a craft ale person, you tend to have more of a writer, don't you? Because you're kind of exploring the different things, whereas if you probably just drink lager or bitter, you'd probably have the same over again.
Yeah.
How are you both doing?
Really upset, angry and annoyed.
Great start, then. What about people?
Happened to watch Starcade 1997 last night.
Not enjoy it?
No.
Adam, how are you?
I'm all right. I think I might be coming down with a cold again. But apart from that, I'm fine. Thanks. How about yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Can't complain. Certainly less than Paul, anyway.
Yeah. Well, he's complaining for the three of us.
I might well be doing that tonight.
Mm.
You got any entertaining stories for us?
No. Not that I can think of.
Well, how are we supposed to fill the first 7 minutes now if you haven't got some anecdote?
I don't even think I've been to a fast food place recently, so...
Have you done anything in the last week?
Stress.
What's stressing you out? Share.
Houses. I don't want to get into anybody that the houses are stressing me out.
He's got a fear of houses.
We're actually recording this outside.
It's crippling.
Well, I went to a SmackDown house show in Birmingham the other night, Scrivens has got no stories to tell.
And how was that?
It was good. I went with Mark and Ben from Skip to the End, and yeah, we saw the SmackDown live roster.
And what's that look like?
It was not too bad. So we had Shinsuke Nakamura versus Dolph Ziggler.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm.
Ty Dillinger turned up. That was his first date on the tour that wasn't SmackDown.
Oh, right.
He teamed with the Fashion Police.
Of course.
What?
And Fandango and Tyler Breeze.
Are they calling themselves the Fashion Police now?
Yes.
Excellent.
Fandango even had tights that said Fashion Popo on the back of them. They were against The Ascension and Aiden English. Then there was some Six Diva thing, and I'm trying to think what else. Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn. Those two can kind of have a good match with one another in their sleep. So, yeah. That was pretty good. Owens won, but it was quite a funny moment on the mic post-match where he was doing a speech about how he was the US champion and the face of America and all this jazz. And then Sami Zayn goes to kick him, but he's still got the mic in his hand as he's about to get kicked. So he's sort of halfway through his sentence and just goes, ah, as he gets kicked. So that was amusing. After the interval, they had the British guys on. So they had Tyler Bate, Trent Seven, and Dan Maloney against Joseph Connors, Pete Dunne, and somebody else who I wasn't familiar with or didn't catch their name. But it was quite good for them. Curiously enough, they didn't announce kind of the babyface trio as being from, you know, Birmingham, Dudley, etc., which you would have thought they'd have done.
In Birmingham.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And then we got the Usos, American Alpha, and the Colognes in a triple threat. But then the main event was champion Randy Orton against AJ Styles against Jinder Mahal in a triple threat match.
Yes.
What?
Really knock it up a notch with Jinder Mahal.
Why is he ascended to main event status?
It's been rather rapid and rather out of nowhere. But yeah, he's challenging Randy Orton on the next SmackDown pay-per-view.
Seriously?
Yes.
I thought that was a joke.
No, that's a real thing that's happening.
Well, I always liked Jinder Mahal.
So you're on board with it?
I'm on board with it, yeah.
I'm just completely bemused. But match of the night, MVP?
Well, easily Owens and Zayn. But Styles was very good to see, obviously putting a good show. They did quite a cool little thing at the start. They did like a little localised promo with Ziggler and Nakamura that played on the mini version of the Titantron that they had where Ziggler was challenging to a match in England and Nakamura accepted. So, yeah, that was quite good.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, the last kind of WWE shows I'd been to over here with the Raw tapings outside of the NXT ones, and they're kind of disappointing in the sense you get the three-minute matches, you get the segments, you get a lot of waiting around, whereas I guess at least with a house show, you know what you're getting. The matches kind of just rattle on and they're a little bit longer than you'd get on a TV taping. So yeah, it was pretty enjoyable, and it was obviously mostly really a family event, and there was kids around us that seemed to be absolutely loving it. There was one in front of us, in fact, who had a real trouble with the cadence of chants. So his attempts to get Let's Go Nakamura into a chant weren't quite working for him, bless him. But he tried.
How old?
Five, maybe.
You could take the baby Scrivens to one.
I'm toying with the idea.
Yeah.
Have you thought about when that might be, his first wrestling show?
I've thought about it. I don't know if I'll be allowed to do it.
Well, not a CZW show, obviously.
No.
If you haven't seen it yet, there's another SmackDown Here Comes the Pain video available on our YouTube page.
Another hellacious bout.
Well, after the shocking events of the Elimination Chamber last time, in this episode, Adam and Paul face off in Divas action. Nay, Pop Divas action, as Christina Aguilera takes on Jennifer Lopez.
Okay.
It's a thriller.
There's a very special guest referee in that bout as well.
I've completely forgotten what it is because we recorded it a little while ago.
Well, search for it on YouTube or follow the links on our social media. And when all these people are watching it for the first time, you can remind yourself.
Okay, I'll remind myself.
This week's audience challenge is brought to you by WWEDVD.co.uk. If you would like to win a copy of the new Diamond Dallas Page DVD or Blu-ray set, head on over to our Facebook page and like, share and comment on the post that accompanies the release of this episode, and we'll pick a winner at random.
Ooh.
Inspired by the WWE naming their July Raw brand pay-per-view after Jerry Lee Lewis's 1957 hit Great Balls of Fire, this week's challenge to you, the audience, was to suggest a song that you would name a pay-per-view after and the main event your show would have. The following are our favourite suggestions. Scott Cavaliero.
Oh.
My pay-per-view would be called WWE, Born in the USA. And the main event would be the Patriot and Kurt Angle against the American Males.
Of course.
That was probably quite an easy one to incorporate the American Males into. But he put a Bruce Springsteen reference in there, so I'm happy.
Jake Roberts. It's WWE Wish You Were Here. The main event consists of a bunch of fans sitting around wishing Punk would come back, Brian would be cleared, and that the Universal Champion was actually around to defend his title regularly.
Is that the Incubus song?
I would think so.
I didn't know if it's Pink Floyd. Yeah. Okay. Either way.
I
don't know the Pink Floyd one, but I like the Incubus.
Yeah, I'm more familiar with the Incubus song. Pink Floyd are kind of, outside of Dark Side of the Moon and The Wall, a bit of a musical blind spot.
For me as well. Really love Dark Side, but then didn't really listen to much else.
Oh, I've heard Piper at the Gates of Dawn as well.
Brandon Sears, WWE, Enter Sandman. Literally just the Sandman's entrance playing for 3 hours.
Slightly shorter than his usual one then.
Yeah.
Martin Anderson, the WWE proudly presents WWE Hound Dog. The main event would be the British Bulldogs taking on the combined forces of the Junkyard Dog and Mad Dog Vachon in a Kennel from Hell match, the winner getting sole custody of Vachon's wooden leg to gnaw on later in their bed. Vince McMahon assures us that the main event would be high class, but that was just a lie.
Paul Durham, WWE Raining Blood. Ric Flair versus Steve Austin versus Terry Funk versus Shawn Michaels versus Mick Foley versus Sandman. In any match that ensures they will all bleed.
So, any match.
Yes.
Sam Hayden. Not only is Vince out of touch, but his hearing is going a bit too. After hearing Iron Maiden's 2 Minutes to Midnight, great song by the way, we are treated to two midgets in a fist fight. I like that.
Peter Hood. And I like this one. In the long-awaited end of the Gang Wars, the DOA, Los Barriquas, and the Nation of Domination all face off in a no-holds-barred death match. The WWF present, In Your House, the first of the gang to die. Paul's sitting there blank-faced. It's a Morrissey song.
Okay.
Stuart Bramley. WWE, Stop Me If You Think You've Heard This One Before. Featuring the epic triple main event of Randy Orton versus John Cena, Kevin Owens versus Sami Zayn, and Roman Reigns versus any and all of your favourite wrestlers.
Do you know that song?
Smiths.
Yay.
Well done.
No, I had no idea. I was guessing like a band that you'd probably like that I don't know. Brady Rack. WWE, The Final Countdown. Main event is Ty Dillinger versus the 1-2-3 Kid in a 30-minute Iron Man WrestleMaths match.
Are you a fan of Ty Dillinger and his number-based gimmick?
Seen very little of him.
But yes.
But I gather he's a 10.
He is a perfect 10.
Well, why don't they have the Texas intro song?
Don't you mean Beautiful South?
Why don't they have that Beautiful South song? You know what? I could have sworn it's Texas. You know, Texas is one of those songs. I didn't mind their stuff when they were around, you know, Texas.
Chris Palmer. WWE presents In Your House, Hairdresser on Fire.
Nice.
Featuring the first, last and only Hair versus Hair Inferno match.
Now that would be a traumatic match to watch.
Now, yes, in reality that would be horrific and completely impossible, but the idea of an inferno match where the object is to set your opponent's hair on fire, yeah, quite like it.
Because how many inferno matches has there been? Like 2 or 3?
Yeah.
And I only really remember the Kane MVP one.
There's the Kane Undertaker one, obviously, from 98, yeah. And there is the
Ring of Fire match with Kane and Bray Wyatt when Bray first came to the main roster, but yeah.
Oh, but that was...
pants.
Yeah, that was awful.
In fact, I don't think any of them were good.
So when anyone gets sets on fire, it's normally their heavily padded arm.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Not their heavily lacquered hair.
If someone, especially with like some rambunctious hairstyle, went and got their head set on fire, that would be awful. Chris Hales. Inspired by Cannibal Corpse, WWE brings you Hammer Smashed Face. The main event will be fairly self-explanatory and horrific.
And probably involve Triple H and Greg the Hammer Valentine.
Ooh, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah.
But not nails.
Not nails.
I'm aware of Cannibal Corpse, but I've got to say, I'm not a fan.
Okay.
They take it a bit too far, even for me.
Yeah. Paul Scrivens. WWE name a show after Iron Maiden's Invaders. It's what they should have called Invasion.
That's very good, very good.
Rob Lee. WWE presents Master of Puppets. Main event, Mankind and Socko versus the Legion of Doom and Rocco. I don't get the Legion of Doom and Rocco bit.
Rocco was their puppet that they bought out in like 1992.
Okay.
But you get Socko, yeah.
Yeah, I get Socko. That's good.
Stuart Brooks. WWE presents Hurt, featuring just Ahmed Johnson matches. See, I can do it too. Stuart Chin Strong. WWE presents Please, Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want. The main event is Roman Reigns versus whoever the fans' current favourite wrestler is. Spoiler alert, you don't get what you want.
No.
See, Braun's injured.
Was it lifting the ambulance?
Possibly. I think it's an arm-related injury, but he's apparently out for about 6 to 8 weeks.
Ah. Does that screw up their plans somewhat?
Yeah, I think it does.
Do you think he really lifted that ambulance?
No, not at all, because he couldn't do that.
Yeah, okay.
Michael Spasiak. WWE presents Fuck the Police. It is main evented by Nails attacking Tyler Breeze and Fandango with a nightstick for 45 minutes.
Sounds hideous.
Mm. Paul Scrivens. WWE Crosstown Traffic. Where it starts late because all of the participants are stuck in crosstown traffic. Robert Barlow. WWF, what's love got to do with it?
What's love?
In which Dude Love runs in on every match with no particular reason.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That one is a great pun. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Liam Bullock. For Charlotte's first pay-per-view loss, the WWE should have gone with WWE, the Queen is dead. Mostly just to hear Michael Cole end the show with, now, we've had several calls during the last few hours about the show name. Just to reassure you, the Queen is not dead. It was a humorous B-level pay-per-view name, which seems to have been taken a bit too literally by one or two network subscribers and a newspaper.
Ben Bloska. It's WWE London Calling. The British Bulldog versus Wade Barrett is the main event, even though both are from up the north, as all Americans think that London and the UK are interchangeable.
Mm. Yes, especially, you know, when they bang on about Bulldog being his hometown in Birmingham.
Mm.
He's definitely not from Birmingham.
Definitely not from Birmingham. Did you want to do a suggestion, Adam, being as Paul keeps having a go? Did you have any song titles you'd like to name a pay-per-view after?
Have a think. Get one on the next round.
Adam White's WWE, The Thing That Should Not Be, where Roman Reigns wins 8 matches in a row.
There you go.
Or King of the Ring 1995. Or Starrcade 1997, for that matter. Paul Scrivens. WWE presents Eye of the Tiger Mask. In which Tiger Mask is just in every match. P2 Polonen. WCW, Ice Ice Baby. The main event is Glacier versus Chili McFreeze.
Glacier?
Glacier. The main event is Glacier. Is that the wrong one?
Glacier?
Glacier. The main event is Glacier versus Chili McFreeze.
Splendid.
Excellent.
Sam Stoke. WWE presents 2 out of 3 ain't bad. 2 count pins now result in wins, meaning matches are a great deal more visceral.
Mick Price. live from the WWE, it is All the Small Things, featuring for the first time ever an 8-on-8 cruiserweights versus midgets match. It isn't like Vince could tell the difference anyway.
True.
Sorry.
He's looking through songs on his phone.
Where do you think I got my inspiration from?
I didn't realise you were cheating.
I was trying to work out how to make one for the middle, for Marty Jannetty being in the middle of the card. But there we go. Doug Ward. Brock Lesnar holds an open challenge with his personal contact information on the line at WWE, the number of the beast.
Very good. That one's really clever. Yeah. Russell Hillier. The only sensible way to end the incredible box office smash of a rivalry between DOA and the Barriquas, a dance-off at WWE Gangnam Style. That I would watch.
My money's on the Barriquas.
Yeah, they can rap, so they can probably dance.
Ben Christian. WWE Baby Got Back. Double main event. Yokozuna versus Rikishi. And Naomi versus Trish Stratus at a thong match. Yeah, probably watch that. Although, I have to say, Yokozuna and Rikishi, both famed for having a large posterior. And Naomi makes the most out of hers by having lots of moves named after it. I don't remember Trish Stratus ever being known as having a massive rump.
I think it's more to do with the fact she had a nice bottom.
Okay, rather than a large bottom.
Would you like to substitute anyone in the match?
No. Yeah,
perfectly happy with Trish.
Perfectly happy with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Paul Scrivens.
Fucking hell.
WCW Price Tag, where Michael Buffer introduces all the matches.
Who's Price Tag a song by?
Jesse J. Paul Scrivens, WWE The Pretender, where fake Razor Ramon faces fake Diesel in the main event. Paul Scrivens, WCW We Are Young, where all the old people are in the matches. Paul Scrivens, WWE, time after time, because you've got John Cena against Randy Orton again. Paul Scrivens, WWE, the Barriquas A team against the B team, the A team Ed Sheeran.
I'm just learning about what he's got on his phone there.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating, really.
Why?
Because it's all rubbish.
That was my kind of family mix playlist.
What about your personal mix playlist?
Hang on, have you got the A team on your family mix playlist?
Yeah, I mean, because
it's about taking heroin or something.
It's probably not that safe, but I guess like a small child probably won't think about it in that kind of that perception.
Mm, well, okay.
Maybe who knows what subliminal effects it's having?
Oh,
yeah.
Paul Scrivens, WWE in your Lego house.
What's it got to do with anything?
Lego House was a song by Ed Sheeran.
You need to know, I haven't got a fucking clue about any Ed Sheeran songs at all.
Paul Scrivens, WWE, Fast Car in Fast Lane.
Okay, I know Tracy Chapman.
Paul Scrivens, WWE, Fire and Inferno Match. Paul Scrivens, WWE, No More Mr. Nice Guy, self-explanatory.
What?
So that was Cooper's song.
Yeah, I know that.
But
Paul Scrivens, WWE, Buddy Holly, just because I like the song. Right, no. Paul Scrivens, WWE. Paul Scrivens, WWE, Buddy Hardcore Holly.
All right, that's enough. You can't delay this anymore.
Hang on, let me just try and get one more. One more. Paul Scrivens, WWE, The Longest Day. That's what they're going to rename WrestleMania as. Right, I'll get back to doing the actual suggestions. I'm sorry. but
have you still actually got one left?
Yeah.
Richard Quarry. Inspired by 90s one-hit wonders Chumbawamba. It's WWE Tub Thumping. The object of the main event is to get knocked down, but then get up again. The most times within a 30-minute time limit. The participants are also required to be singing when they're winning.
That is fantastic.
That's actually the best
really,
one.
Really, really good.
Plus also, not beyond the realms of possibility that they'd name a show after that.
The name WWE Tub Thumping. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, but how surreal is Great Balls of Fire? So
it's a bit weird.
Tub Thumping seems perfectly plausible. Thank you very much to everyone for all of your suggestions, especially this Paul Scrivens guy for the 12 suggestions he had read out in this one episode.
Do you love pro wrestling merchandise? Do you love surprises? Then what could be better than a box full of wrestling goodies delivered to your door each month? Go to www.wrestlecrate.co.uk right now and select your monthly plan starting at just $11.99. WrestleCrate offer you a mix of content from the WWE and other top wrestling promotions around the world, handpicking you loot from Ring of Honor, Chikara, Progress, Preston City Wrestling and more. Inside a WrestleCrate, you will find exclusive shirts, superstar autographs, action-packed DVDs and collectibles you won't find elsewhere, such as books, caps, magazines, pins, badges, prints, homeware, colouring books, bottle openers, toys, games and more. And if you want 10% off your first crate, enter New Gen Podcast at the checkout to receive a discount. WrestleCrate, the world's first wrestling subscription box. It's Sunday, December the 28th, 1997, and we are live from the MCI Centre in Washington, D.C., in front of a live crowd of 17,500, including 1,448 comps, for a live gate of $543,000. Those in attendance spent an all-time company record of $161,961 in one night on merchandise. The show drew a 1.9 buy rate.
Holy fuck.
Approximately 650,000 buys for a company gross of $6.85 million.
Is that like 650,000 really upset people?
No WCW pay-per-view after this will draw as high a buy rate, and the show will stand as WCW's most financially successful ever pay-per-view.
How ironic.
That is quite amazing though, isn't it?
Yep.
Quite amazing, especially when we've heard like 0.7 buy rates
and 0.3s and stuff like that. Yeah.
And then, 1.9.
Were they too busy rubbing themselves in money to put on a good show?
I'm getting the feeling you're a little bit down on this show, Paul.
Just a tad.
But yeah, I guess the anticipation is there for Hogan Sting. It shows, I guess, that, and we'll get to it later, like if you hold off, you can draw.
Yeah, you do a proper build for something that carries on and people really anticipate. And we saw to, I guess, a lesser extent with when Kane was introduced, as where you just had this long storyline that people were really itching to see what happened to it. And this has been going on for, over a year?
Yeah.
And so people have been expecting it. And, yeah, when you finally got the payoff for it, people will pay to watch it.
The other thing I'll say is, and we'll discuss it when we discuss the main event, is that they announce it like a good 2 months in advance. So it's literally just after Halloween Havoc that they say, yeah, the main event of Starrcade will be Hogan versus Sting. So it's not something that, you know, is only built for 3 weeks. It's closer to like 9 or 10 that people actually know that's going to be the main event.
And you had all that really good stuff with Sting being offered like to wrestle Vincent and things like that. Wasn't it?
I don't think that was an offer, but...
I get what you're saying. So they come out and offer like all these jabronis from the NWO and Sting's like, no. And people know where it's going, but it gives a really good draw in and that sort of stuff I really like.
The Crow is a 1994 American fantasy action film starring Brandon Lee and apparently also a WCW pay-per-view opening video package directed by Eric Bischoff and starring Steve Borden.
I thought this was brilliant, personally. Like this cinematic opening was very good.
Directed by Eric Bischoff?
This probably was. I don't mean The Crow was directed by Eric Bischoff.
It was good, though. The opening video for this, I thought, really amazing, really different. I know we've talked a lot about the WWF's opening videos being really, really good. And they are, but this is really good in a different way. It's an imitation of what they're doing.
Yeah.
This is, like I say, this is something very filmic that they've done.
Yeah, and we criticised them last month for a really shoddy opening to In Your House, D-Generation X. And we slated WCW generally for their opening video packages for not being very good. Or
certainly just being substandard compared to what the WWF are doing.
But, yeah, this is actually awesome. Sting lurks on a rainy rooftop as images of Hollywood Hulk Hogan and the NWO flash across the screen. He watches from the shadows. He's witnessed the ruin of an empire. Now he seeks the ruin of one man. Sting drops down off the roof and picks up his baseball bat, and we zoom in on his eye, showing the event logo. Yeah, very cool, well-produced, atmospheric opening to the show that kind of succinctly tells the story that's happening here.
Yeah, and makes it seem like a really big deal.
It'd be good if they had some follow-up.
It would be.
Yeah, no, I did think this was very good, and like I say, it's very different. Promising start.
Tony Schiavone welcomes us to the biggest night in the history of this grand sport as pyro and thunder sound effects go off. It's going to be the grandest night ever.
The grandest night ever, you say?
Tony says there's 24,000 fans crammed in, and there just isn't. He's joined by the American Dream Dusty Rhodes and the Professor Iron Mike Tenay. Tony says there's been a lot of controversy as to who will referee the Hogan-Sting match tonight. You'd have thought they'd have ironed that out a bit sooner. But what better way to decide who that important job goes to than picking a name out of a hat?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, this is one element of this whole story that it doesn't really make too much sense to me.
Tony throws to shots of WCW wrestlers in the crowd here to watch the show. Among those shown are Harlem Heat, Paul Scrivens, Mortis, still wearing his mask, Disco Inferno, Alex Wright, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Hugh Morris, Glacier, Rey Mysterio Jr. and the Repo Man.
I quite like this. I quite like, because it's not often you see a load of wrestlers in attendance.
Mm.
And it made it seem like this is such a big deal because the whole like kind of balance of the company's on the line. Everyone's there to see what happens.
And I like it that for the majority of them, they were still kind of quite clearly in gimmick.
Yeah.
Yes.
And granted, I'm also aware that they could have all watched it for free in the tellies in the back, but they all apparently paid for their tickets and came out.
Well, that is mentioned that A, they paid their own plane fare, and B, they bought their own tickets. Surely there's some sort of comp system working for WCW?
Or they just make so much money in WCW that it's nothing.
But it's all off their own talent.
I wonder if the wrestlers in the matches had to pay for tickets.
When you take out the WCW portion of it, that what their talent paid, it's like about 1.5 mil.
Or the amount of roster in attendance is a good 1,000.
Yeah. Mm. They do have a big roster.
They do have a huge roster, yes.
And they're paying them all the time.
Yes.
It's a completely different pay structure, isn't it?
There is, in fact, people that they've never used once that they've been paying for years.
That'd be an interesting thing to know, is who had the longest run on basically full-time pay without ever doing anything?
The Genius is there from 95 to 99 and paid for the whole time and never wrestles once.
4 years?
Yeah. Mm.
That's amazing.
They pay Nails for like about 18 months and never use them on television.
I guess that's what just happens when you have an inexhaustible well of money.
Yeah. Dusty says the word destiny about 15 times to hammer home what he feels the theme of the evening is. Destiny has brought Hogan, Sting and the whole world here tonight for this huge event. Before we get going, Tony tells us that Kevin Nash is not here tonight to face the Giant, and that's all the announcers can tell us for now.
And they continue to tell us for a long time.
Our opening contest is Eddie Guerrero versus Dean Malenko for the WCW Cruiserweight title. After their classic cruiserweight title match at Halloween Havoc, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio Jr. would face off on the November 3rd episode of Nitro, when they were on opposing sides of a Strange Bedfellows tag team match that pitted Guerrero and Dean Malenko against Rey Jr. and Lord Steven Regal. After Mysterio accidentally dropkicked his partner Regal, Guerrero seemed to have the match won for his team, ready to hit the frog splash to Rey. Before he could hit it, though, Dean Malenko tagged in and applied the Texas Cloverleaf to Rey, with Mysterio quickly tapping out, much to Eddie's chagrin. A Halloween Havoc rematch for the Cruiserweight title between Mysterio and Guerrero would take place on the November 10th Nitro, with Eddie capturing the title from Rey after a frog splash. Post-match, Dean Malenko walked to the ring and went nose-to-nose with Guerrero. Malenko and Guerrero would face off for the Cruiserweight title the following week on the November 17th Nitro in an excellent match that went to a no contest after neither man could answer the referee's 10 count following a top rope back suplex by Malenko. Eddie Guerrero then made a sidestep into commentary for a few weeks, appearing, amongst other matches, at the announce booth during Malenko's match with Prince Iaukea on the December 8th Nitro, followed by the Iceman's contest with Fit Finlay the following week on the December 15th show. Whilst Guerrero wouldn't interject in the former, which Dean won, he would distract Malenko in the latter, allowing Finlay to pick up the win with a tombstone. The following week, on the December 22nd Nitro, Eddie would take on Finlay, with Finlay picking up the win when Guerrero just walked away from the match, claiming that he didn't need this before his big match at Starrcade. The Wrestling Observer seems to suggest that at one point this bout could have included Rey Mysterio Jr. to turn it into a triple threat match, but none of the television in the weeks leading up to Starrcade seemed to indicate this.
That's a shame, because I think that would have been good.
Yeah, it's a real shame he's not on this pay-per-view. Dean Malenko makes his entrance to a decent reaction. Tony continues to talk about Kevin Nash as the Iceman makes his way to the ring. Cruiserweight champion Eddie Guerrero is out next, to not much of a reaction to begin with.
Not as much as you'd expect, because he's been fairly highly profiled, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Recently, and he's over as a kind of this greasy, weaselly heel type character.
Is it just me, or on WCW, do they seem to take a long time to start coming out after their music originally starts playing?
Yes, there does feel like there's a bit of a delay on this show between people's music starting and them coming out.
And I don't think that helps Pops,
no.
Really.
Is it just me, or in WCW, are they still rocking the mullet? In match one, there's a guy with a mullet. In WWF at this point, they're basically extinct.
I mean, it does look as well like Eddie has started to refine his character work a little bit more.
Yeah, totally.
So that seems of a much higher quality. So matches were always great before, but now he seems a little bit more characterised.
He stops to stare disapprovingly at the Disco Inferno as he makes his way to the ring. And yes, he does look very greasy.
Yeah, maybe that's why he's got the mullet. Because when you've got that much hair,
it's easier to be greasy.
You can over-grease it, and it's very, very obvious.
He seemingly mocks Dean Malenko for not having a mullet.
He does. I picked up on that. Yes, and I thought, fair point, fair point.
He spends a good 30 seconds just rubbing his head, doesn't he?
But, sort of, I've got a mullet, you've not. What do you think about that?
Dean Malenko seems fairly nonplussed.
He's nonplussed about everything.
Sign in the crowd. Hogan is older than Dirt.
How old is Dirt?
Quite old.
After using referee Charles Robinson for a distraction, Eddie attacks and takes Dean down, but Malenko quickly takes the advantage, drilling Eddie in the head to a reaction. Tony Schiavone continues to talk about Sting and Hulk Hogan. Dusty witters on about Destiny, and occasionally Mike Tenay mentions the match going on in the ring.
Yeah, I do have a note that up to this point, 87% of the words used on this pay-per-view have been Destiny.
Are you okay with them talking this much about Hogan and Sting?
I am, but not during a match. Or not during when the match has actually started up. It's fine to have lots and lots of talk about it, but we've already done lots of talk about it in the opening bit where you've got the commentators on screen. But if they just steamroll it over a pretty decent match with loads of commentary about something else that's happening, I'm less keen on that.
Yeah, they probably should pay more attention to the match.
Eddie rakes Dean's face along the ropes, but Dean fights back with a kick for a two count. Dean follows up with a nice suplex that gets a pop and goes back to punching Eddie in the face as the crowd counts along. He stops at six. They trade waistlocks as the crowd chant Eddie sucks. Eddie applies a wrist lock and gracefully steps up to the top rope, leaping off for a head scissors, but Dean drops him with a powerbomb.
Yeah, it's like...
awesome.
Like, he just casts it into power. That was brilliant. And gets a very good pop for it. This crowd, I think, are up for it tonight.
Malenko jackknifes for the pin, but only gets a two. Malenko nails a gorgeous Alabama slam, which the crowd pop for, and he gets another two.
It's huge, isn't it? And you don't see it as often as you'd like.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Alabama slam is amazing. Fairly straightforward to do if you're doing it to someone of a comparable weight to you, but you don't see it very often.
I wonder if it's one of those that has like a high concussion rate, perhaps. Dean tries for more pins, but Eddie bridges out. Malenko hits a power slam for another two count, and Eddie becomes frustrated. He gets on his knees and bangs on the canvas, begging Malenko to come on. When Malenko goes for him, Eddie scuttles out of the ring on his knees.
That takes some doing, I reckon, to run on your knees that fast.
And scuttling is absolutely the word.
Yes. Scuttling is a great word.
The crowd also hate him for it.
Yeah, he gets mega heat.
Eddie sneaks back into the ring and goes for Dean's leg, taking him down. Guerrero with an uppercut, and he spreads Malenko across the rope for punches and chops. Malenko fights back with punches of his own, but Eddie pokes him in the eye. Eddie with a snapmare and a stomp across Dean's face before a dropkick follows. Eddie taunts the crowd and gets good heat for that. Guerrero looks for a suplex, but Malenko blocks it with knees and drops Eddie across the rope on his stomach.
Yeah, that was good, yeah.
Malenko clotheslines Guerrero for a two count. Malenko applies a chin lock before quickly turning it into a leg scissors. Eddie rolls to the ropes to break. Malenko flapjacks Eddie to the mat for another reaction from the crowd, and Eddie begs off, asking Dean if he can have a timeout. Eddie decides he wants a handshake and kisses Malenko's boot. Guerrero tells the crowd, who are presumably telling Malenko not to go for it, to shut up. Malenko hits a dropkick to the prone Guerrero, and Eddie bails to the outside.
Do you think he perhaps does that begging off bit a little bit too much?
No, I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so snivelling, isn't it? The way that he gets down and kisses his feet.
I mean, I'm not saying he doesn't do it well, but for me, it perhaps just goes that well a bit too much and it becomes a little too predictable, perhaps.
Didn't he just do it once in this match?
He does the begging off bit on his knees before he runs away.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily exactly the same thing that he's doing, but it's that same tactic, and I think it can become a little repetitive.
But going and kissing the actual foot is like... really weaselly.
Really, really. And it's amazing to do it. It works so well with Dean Malenko because he has no expression whatsoever for it. So it just works fantastically that Eddie's trying and fawning in this way and getting nothing back from it.
Guerrero re-enters and they go for a test of strength. Malenko gets the advantage and gets Eddie down to the mat, stamping on his fingers before hitting another dropkick. Guerrero fights back and rams Malenko into the corner before looking for a tornado DDT. Malenko, however, just pushes Eddie off.
Mm.
Eddie charges and Malenko alley-oops him over his head, face first into the turnbuckle.
Alley-oop is a term that I've not heard for a little while.
Malenko hits a side suplex and rolls over for a two count. Guerrero reverses an Irish whip and again looks for a suplex, but again Malenko blocks it. But this time, Eddie slides over, and just as it looks like Malenko is dropping Eddie's stomach first over the ropes, Eddie grabs Dean by the head and snaps him backwards over the top rope.
Mm. Nice.
Guerrero drags Malenko down onto the apron and focuses an attack on the knee, going outside in and inside out over the ropes. Guerrero uses the ring post to further damage Malenko's leg and places the leg between the steps and the steel ring post, hitting a drop kick.
Interesting use of the steps.
Yeah.
Guerrero takes more time to jaw with the crowd, blowing a kiss to someone in the crowd as he rolls Dean back into the ring. We get a shot of Ultimo Dragon in the crowd, with the Repo Man pulling a silly face sat behind him.
It's amazing that the Repo Man's still a thing at this point.
Well, he's not the Repo Man here. He's the bailiff.
What?
No, he's not. He's just Barry Darso. But he does get a golfing gimmick at some point.
What? That's all right.
Mr. Hole-in-One.
A golfing gimmick.
Yeah, he gives golfing lessons on WCW Saturday Night.
Have you ever got a hole-in-one?
No, but I'm guessing you have.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. There we
go. Mini golf or actual golf?
Pitch and putt.
Crazy golf.
Have we ever told the story of Wii Golf on your Wii, Adam?
It wasn't my Wii.
Was it not your Wii? Oh, no, it was your Wii.
He and Pulse bought it in the same way that I might buy a Twix. He bought a Nintendo Wii.
Yeah. But somebody beat your scores, didn't they, Paul, on your copy of Wii Sports?
Bannerman Sam.
And what did you do?
Try to delete it? Or
no, you continually played badly with his character
until, that's right, yes.
Until the averages came down and you were top again.
Does that make me seem like a small and petty person?
Tad.
I am.
Back in the ring, and Guerrero continues his attack on the knee of Malenko. Guerrero hits a lovely powerbomb for a two count.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that.
Guerrero leaps up on Malenko's shoulders, but Malenko counters with what I'm going to describe as a wheelbarrow German suplex for a two.
Yeah.
There were some nice kind of almost like amalgamations of moves in this match.
Yeah.
Where it kind of starts off as one thing, they kind of fairly seamlessly transition into another. It's very good.
Mm. Like your sentences, but without the seamless transition.
Yeah, probably quite like that.
Malenko gets a lovely backbreaker off a head scissors attempt for another two. So I think that's what you're meaning there, aren't you? Like, it kind of looks like it's going to be a head scissors. He tilt-a-whirls around and Malenko hits the backbreaker. The announcers sell that Malenko is struggling to get over the assault on his leg. Guerrero goes to the top, but Malenko joins him there. They tussle for a bit, but the sequence ends disappointingly, with Malenko pushing Guerrero to the mat. Malenko gets a two from it.
It kind of just looked like they hadn't decided what they were going to do for that spot.
And then just thought, shall we bother? Nah. Malenko hits another beautiful powerbomb that the crowd loves and looks for the cloverleaf, but Eddie blocks it with a kick to the knee. Malenko dodges the dropkick to the knee attempt, and Eddie sails to the outside. Eddie goes to the top and drop kicks Dean's knee before hitting a frog splash to the knee for the three count at 14:57. Guerrero looks pleased with himself post-match and leaves with his belt.
Top rope drop kick to the knee.
Mm.
That's cool.
It was very precise, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I thought it was quite impressive because I have seen bits like that before, but this was done very well.
Good frog splash. Breaks his penis on Dean Malenko's hip.
What?
For the three.
What?
He does. He hits him in a really weird way, and I swear he goes dick first onto Dean Malenko's hip. But apparently, for the win.
That would have been amazing if he just did it and vomited.
Oh, my nuts.
But really good match.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's very, very good, actually. I mean, I didn't think it was quite as good as perhaps some of the ones that we've seen before, maybe like Eddie, Ray, Dean before, but it was not far off at all. Very, very good opener.
Yeah, I've got this down as, really good. It didn't have sustained heat, I don't think. That's an issue we'll see as we go on with this crowd. But they awoke for the big spots, and this had some nice ones. The power bombs, the wheelbarrow German suplex thing, and the backbreaker were all good stuff.
Yeah.
Eddie's assault on the knee were logical, if not thrilling, at times, and played into the finish with a unique version of his trademark manoeuvre. The two have definitely had better matches against each other, but this was a good way to start the show, and certainly comparable to, if slightly less spectacular than, the WWF's opener. So we had quite an extended discussion about Brian Christopher, Taka Michinoku, which had some pretty spectacular stuff from Taka. I thought this was comparable, but perhaps didn't have the high spots that Taka produced.
A slightly different style of things, if anything. And that's the issue. I mean, there wasn't necessarily much in the way of like high-flying moves like that. I don't know how you describe it, like the springboard thing that Taka does. That, in terms of a single move, is the best thing out of either of these two matches, in my eyes. But the kind of the technical ability, and like I say, those moves where you kind of think, oh, I'm going to get a cool move here, and then you get a different cool move instead, at the end of it, everybody's happy.
Has Eddie now put on a bit too much muscle to do stuff like that, or did he just never do it anyway?
He was never a flyer in the way that, Taka is or Ray is. He was certainly an aerial guy, but he doesn't look anywhere near as bulked up as he'll be currently.
Oh, he's not, but he's looking definitely like heavily muscled for his size.
I mean, he's still capable of some really good feats of agility, like the step up the ropes and stuff.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, is this kind of like, is this the perfect balance that he's got at the minute? So he's got enough muscle to actually do like some really quite cool power moves on the right sized person.
Yeah.
But he's still got enough agility to do the kind of like the really, really graceful, like acrobatic stuff as well. And as you know, we all know, as he goes on further, and I guess in order to make it in Vince's company and get to the top at the time where he did, you've got to be super muscle guy. And he must, God, I don't know how much weight he actually puts on in muscle by the time he sort of finishes up, but he can't do the same sort of stuff anymore.
No.
Because he's over-encumbered.
Well, there's a sign, isn't there, in the background at this point? It says, McMahon fears steroids.
Mm. I don't think fears is the right word.
Loves.
Yeah, might be a different one.
Go ahead, ask how many Sting fans are out there. Go ahead, ask that question.
Hey, yo.
You gotta admit that being in D.C. for the holidays is just too sweet. And the NWO's glad to be here. And you might have heard by now that we're taking a little survey. It's real, real simple. We want to know if you're with us or if you're against us.
There you go.
So, how many people here in D.C. came to see WCW? Now, how many people here in D.C. came to see the...
We got him.
One more for the good guys.
He's like 0 for 3 for the last three
programs.
Okay,
now I know everybody wants to see Hollywood beat up Sting, so...
He's wrong.
And nobody is more interested in that match than me, because at Super Brawl, Scott Hall wrestles the winner. Lucky me. Okay, now for some bad news. The true giant, the 6'10 genetic marvel, and my big buddy, one half of the real tag team champions, Big Kevin Nash. Hey, hear me out. Big Kevin Nash is not gonna be here tonight.
So what's the reason here?
Yeah.
Hey, he told me if you had a problem with it, that you could meet him down there.
Down where?
Down where, you ask?
Down where?
You know where. So anyway, where's the referee? Get somebody out here and tell that big goof that he won. Hey, Giant, hey, Franken goof. You just tell everybody that you won, okay?
He's asking for a referee and telling the Giant, hey, you won because Kevin Nash.
Like a forfeit.
Well, turn around.
Yeah. Here
Scott,
you go.
Turn around, Scott Hall. Here he comes. It's not a referee.
No, don't turn around. Let him sneak up behind him and grab a hold of him.
That's 7'4" and 480 pounds headed to the ring.
We still have not gotten a... you know, the Giant walks out, but if I were the Giant, I would be very, very weary of the situation here.
Well, there's nothing to keep Scott Hall from stripping down and getting it on
that's,
with him, you know
what
I mean?
That's a great point.
I mean, you know, big man with a big talk, let's do it.
The Giant has no cast on his hand. None. Maybe that's why he stayed home. Or stay wherever he stayed.
First of all, let me start off by saying I'm a forgiving man. Kevin Nash, I can understand why Kevin Nash isn't here. If I had to wrestle me, I wouldn't want to be here either. Let me also say that I'm a patient man. I'll be here in professional wrestling for a long time. Sooner or later, Kevin Nash is going to come back. And when he does, he'll find out that I'm the one true real giant. And another thing, Slick, I got another message for Kevin Nash.
The NWO theme hits, and Tony Schiavone acts surprised, wondering what's going on. Like, this isn't something that happens every 20 minutes on every WCW show. Scott Hall, wearing a WCW tag team belt, even though he isn't currently a member of the WCW tag team champions, saunters to the ring as Tony, Dusty and Mike wonder if he can shed some light on why Kevin Nash isn't there tonight.
Now, this is weird, and this came up when Stuart was watching Nitro, is that I see Scott Hall and Kevin Nash wander around with the tag belts on, and I've not really seen all the build-up to it, so I'm not tag champions. And then the Steiners come out, and they're tag champions. I'm like, hang on, what's going on? And you said, yep, they're the actual tag champions. So why does Hall have a tag belt?
I don't know.
Did he just get one made?
Well, presumably.
He bought it from the WCW online store.
Possibly. But yeah, Nash and Hall just wander around claiming they're the tag champs, even though they're not.
It's pretty easy to buy belts now, isn't it? But replica belts. So maybe just like all the WWE guys should claim that they're the Universal Champion.
But I guess that actually Hall and Nash probably have more TV time than the Steiners. So if you're a casual viewer, do the casual viewers just think that they're the tag champs?
Presumably, yes.
I don't understand.
In case you hadn't heard, the NWO sent out a press release saying Kevin Nash wouldn't be at Starrcade.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that.
I wonder what other factions have press releases. Do Los Boricuas have press releases?
Press release.
We're only sending the B team out today, boys.
Miguel Perez is not here.
Here's a press release from Jose Estrada Jr. Weird.
And Chains is getting in by sending out a press release to say his bike's in the shop.
Scott Hall does his now trademark routine, asking the crowd if they're there to see WCW or the NWO. Sometimes they're popular, sometimes they're not, but every time Hall just acts like they are.
Yeah, but they do finish off his catchphrase for him.
Yeah, it's one of those things where...
So is he over, or do they just think that that's what you've got to do?
I didn't get that, because I had no idea by the end of this which side the crowd were on.
Well, yeah, it's a weird one. Like, if they're in a really pro-WCW place, then the crowd won't shout the NWO thing at the end of it, but generally everywhere else... Even if the crowd are predominantly pro-WCW, they will still finish the catchphrase. Mm. So it doesn't really make sense.
Odd.
He's also gone from saying one more for the bad guys to one more for the good guys. No. So I don't know if he thinks they've turned face. Hall gets major heat for saying that people want to see Hogan beat up Sting and references a pending title shot that he's earned at Super Brawl. Hall offers no reason as to why Nash isn't at the show and tells the crowd if they have a problem with it, Nash told him they could meet him down there.
You know where.
I didn't... Because somebody says like down where, don't they?
I felt like shouting, I don't know where, yeah. Scott. Please tell me.
Well, the best thing is, and I'll obviously include the audio, if you really listen, you can just hear one bloke go, down where?
Yeah.
Down there, says Hall. Down where? Asks the same guy. Hall says, you know where. The guy responds, where?
But I didn't know where.
Good dialogue.
I was kind of infuriated. But do you not think that with the reactions that it was getting, that actually I felt Scott Hall looked a little bit embarrassed when he said he was going to face the winner of the Sting Hogan match?
Did they not really pop for that announcement?
No, he kind of like, there was just a bit of nothing and he just like, kind of looking around. I felt a bit sorry for him.
Hall says the Giant can just tell people he won and starts doing an imitation of him. Obviously, he faces the opposite way to the entrance so the Giant can walk out. The Giant grabs the mic and says he understands why Kevin Nash isn't there. If he had to wrestle him, he wouldn't be there either.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense to
me. It can be taken two ways. Giant says he'll be in wrestling for a long time.
He's not wrong.
Yeah, true story. Hall throws his toothpick in the Giant's face and attacks, but the Giant quickly takes him down, which Hall sells well.
Yes.
Giant hits a massive gorilla press slam and signals it's time for the choke slam, but changes his mind and hits a really good jackknife powerbomb instead to a huge pop.
Yeah. Why didn't the Big Show just start doing more powerbombs? Because he's really good at them.
Yeah, I thought that was good, and I liked the fact that he did raise his little taunt after that.
Giant leaves, so Scott Norton and Vincent come out to help Scott Hall to the back. Mike Tenay mentions that we still have no idea why Kevin Nash isn't there. Probably don't want to raise that issue.
Yeah.
I still have no idea why Kevin Nash isn't there.
Why isn't Kevin Nash here?
So yes, Mike is correct, and none of this leaves us any closer to deciphering exactly why Kevin Nash isn't there. Apparently, the day before the show, WCW were informed that Nash had suffered a mild heart attack.
Oh, shit.
Although it was also reported that it was actually just a bad case of indigestion that caused massive chest pains. This leaves two options for why Nash didn't attend the event. Firstly, Nash's father had died from a heart attack under the age of 40, and Nash, 39 at the time, was so concerned about his own health that he mistook the symptoms, which Eric Bischoff says Nash was prone to doing in his autobiography Controversy Creates Cash. Or, secondly, after being informed he was booked to lose to the Giant, Nash just decided not to turn up.
Well, both feasible.
Given what Finn Martin in Powerslam describes as Nash's appalling reputation for self-serving behaviour, apparently few believed the former and were more inclined to go along with the latter.
Yeah, because he could have just got some Gaviscon.
Bischoff also says it's not surprising that people jumped to the conclusion that Nash was playing games, but that he believed that not to be the case.
Okay, well, I mean, if there was, you know, hereditary issues, then you could understand why someone would be a bit paranoid if they started getting any sort of, like, bad chest pains.
Yeah.
But also, if there is this reputation where you only serve yourself and, you know, you hang around with Hogan, he said, don't worry, brother, you don't have to lose to anyone you don't want to, then maybe that explains it as well.
And also, if you do have those hereditary issues that you can use as a convenient excuse for not turning up...
It does give you pretty much a free ticket.
Yeah.
Is this common in WCW in terms of people not wanting to lose so they avoid it?
Yes.
So as well, if there's previous for it, again, like if other people do it, he would probably feel more entitled to do it.
And we've discussed this kind of quite a lot, and especially with Brett kind of coming in, like he's stepping into a political minefield.
Yeah.
And yeah, Nash is very much close to the top of that tree in terms of holding the cards.
Who is kind of at the top making those decisions about winning, losing? Is it Bischoff, Hogan, a mix?
Well,
other players?
Obviously, you've got the Booker. I think at this point it's a combination of Terry Taylor and Kevin Sullivan, and they're probably about eighth on the tree. But at the tops, you know, in theory, you've got Bischoff, but he's very much controlled by Hogan and probably to an extent Nash and Hall, because that they hold a lot of power just in terms of we're the guys who kind of turned your product around.
So it must be hard for Brett, because he's come from his problems obviously with Sean and with Vince, and he's in many ways come into a more trickier nest where Bischoff is in control yet is orchestrated by Hogan, who is in many ways worse than Shawn Michaels, and Nash, who's rapidly getting there, and Hall, that's somewhere around there as well. So you've got a bigger range of people that can cause you issue.
My biggest concern, if I was Brett going there, is that the fact that it's Hall and Nash are near the top of the tree because they're Shawn's buddies.
Yeah.
And they're not going to...
Yeah, there's an association, isn't there?
They're not going to help him out.
Don't forget as well, you've got them potentially... Roddy Piper is another one who certainly doesn't like losing when he doesn't have to.
Yeah.
Ric Flair certainly holds a lot of power.
Yeah.
Sting certainly holds a lot of power. Even Lex Luger has a degree of, I'm a big star here.
And also, if you eat the wrong sandwich in the locker room, it's potential that Scott Steiner might kill you.
There is that too.
Because he's there.
Yes, there's a lot going on.
It just seemed like a really turbulent atmosphere in the company, because there's so many people and there's so many big players.
And so many egos.
Who all seem to be able to find a way to get themselves served and to pull lots of punches everywhere. Interesting.
Up next is a six-man tag team match pitting Ray Traylor and the Steiner Brothers against Scott Norton, Vincent, and Macho Man Randy Savage.
I've not seen a Virgil match since he fought the Million Dollar Man.
I've not seen a Virgil match since he fought Yokozuna.
The last time we saw the artist formerly known as the Big Boss Man, he was a card-carrying member of the NWO as Big Bubba Rogers.
Uh-huh.
At the beginning of the February 17th episode of Nitro, Bubba was attacked off-screen, with the implication being that it was Diamond Dallas Page to set the pair up for a match down the line. In reality, Bubba had suffered a back injury that was expected to keep him out for about 6 weeks, but ended up keeping him out for over 6 months.
when he returned on the September 1st episode of Nitro. He was interviewed prior to a bout with Prince Iaukea by Mean Gene Okerlund. In a promo somewhat similar to when John Tenta declared he was no longer a shark, Bubba informed Gene that he was just a man named Ray Traylor, in fact, and that whilst he was injured, potentially facing the end of his career, the NWO were nowhere to be found to support him, except for Eric Bischoff sending him a registered letter informing him he was no longer needed within the ranks of the New World Order. Traylor then claimed he taught himself to walk again following his back injury, using a picture of Bischoff as motivation. Naturally, Traylor would then be the victim of weeks' worth of attacks by the NWO, including one on the November 10th Nitro, where following a defeat at the hands of Randy Savage, the Macho Man proceeded to hit a trio of elbow drops to Traylor after the bell, whilst Elizabeth spray-painted him with the NWO logo. A similar attack would occur on the November 24th Nitro, except this time the group tried to write their name on Traylor's head with a marker pen, but the pen wouldn't work. Live TV. Traylor would finally receive some assistance from WCW wrestlers on the December 9th episode of Saturday Night, when tag team champions the Steiner Brothers saved him from an NWO assault following a match with US champion Kurt Hennig. Traylor would return the favour on the December 15th Nitro, when the NWO trio of Conan, Scott Norton and Vincent attacked the Steiners, with Traylor evening the numbers. The go-home December 22nd Nitro would see a similar brawl following Vincent interfering in a bout between Rick Steiner and Scott Norton, setting up the six-man tag team match here, though it was never formally announced. Macho Man Randy Savage is a replacement in the bout for Conan, who was in Mexico with family problems at the time, so couldn't make the show.
Okay.
Adam, you did also see this bout between Rick Steiner and Scott Norton, where Scott Norton drops Rick Steiner on his head.
I've got to be honest, it didn't look very nice. It looked fucking horrible.
Imagine going for a power slam and making it about of a third of the way round, but just going, oh, I'll finish it anyway.
Mm.
Yeah, it looked painful.
Yeah, so kind of full pelt, picked up, and then dropped on the top of his head.
Doesn't sound good.
It didn't look good.
Having just left to take Scott Hall to the back, Vincent and Scott Norton walk back to the ring.
This was ridiculous, right? So they come down to help him. They walk up. They literally get to the kind of to the curtain. Literally to the curtain. Presumably, they just push Scott Hall over and turn around and come back out.
Sorry, mate, got a match.
Yeah.
Vincent is apparently the NWO director of security.
What?
Vincent is terrible. And dressed in jeans.
Well, he's dressed in jeans and t-shirt, and not in a way like John Cena is, where it looks like his gear.
I thought it was more like a jumper.
Just yeah. In the way that, like, I've forgotten my kit, just get something out of Lost Property.
He could have easily been a member of the crowd.
Yeah.
Dave Penza tries to announce Conan as their partner, but Norton grabs the mic to stop him. The Steiner brothers and Ray Traylor make their entrance together, and the announcers sell it as a sign that WCW is unified against the NWO. Norton and Vincent point to the entrance, and the NWO A theme, Macho Man version, hits to bring us Randy Savage and Elizabeth, who is looking lovely.
She is looking lovely. Again, a mystery as to how someone can look like younger and more attractive, a clear sort of like 10 years from where she first like turned up. So she looked older and worse in the 1980s, and then 10 years later, she looks like loads better. It's really weird. She looks younger.
I think it's 80s haircuts. They just added age.
And I think, yeah, like shoulder pads and things like that. Just fashions have changed. Because I think it happened with Carol Vorderman as well, who looked older in 1982 than she did in like 1995.
The announcers sell shock that Randy Savage is taking Conan's spot in the match. Savage jaws with some of the WCW wrestlers in the crowd as he makes his way to the ring. Scott Steiner and Randy Savage start, with Savage stalling for a good long time.
Well, hang on, before this, I don't know if you noticed, there was a guy who basically looks like Bill Frindle, who tells Savage to get to the ring is taking so long.
Who's Bill Frindle?
I thought you might ask that. Bill Frindle is the...
Is he your mate's dad's brother or something?
No, he's not anymore, he was.
Is he dead?
He is now, yeah. Test Match Specials, scorer and statistician.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, very much a job I would like to have. But he also had... he had the nickname, The Bearded Wonder, which is a brilliant nickname.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah, he kind of looked like him. So I didn't know if it was an official or just somebody's dad that just kind of wandered around like, all right, mate, this is taking your time.
Early on, and Savage is frustrated by the strength of Scott Steiner, so Savage slapped him around the face.
Bad idea.
The announcers talk about how the Steiners are apparently always very businesslike and don't get angry, and they're unflappable.
I think they get angry quite a lot. And sometimes they're not very businesslike, and I think they are very flappable.
Steiner gets a shoulder block and flexes his muscles at Savage. They trade slaps to the face before Savage whips Steiner to the ropes, with Norton kneeing Scott in the back. Macho Man scoops Steiner up and drops him neck first over the rope before tagging, oh God, Vincent.
Is he qualified to be head of security because he was a bodyguard at one point in his career?
I'm guessing that's the tenuous link. Savage continues his assault from the outside as Vincent chokes Steiner in the ring. Scott Norton tags in and Scott Steiner gets a boot up on a charge, but Norton almost Samoan drops Steiner following a charge. It wasn't quite a Samoan drop, but yeah.
No. What did you feel about the start of this match? Because to me it felt a bit clunky.
Yes.
And a bit scruffy.
Yeah, I agree. Norton hits a backbreaker and tags Randy Savage, who enters via an axe handle off the top. Scott Steiner hits a double underhook powerbomb and a gorilla press before a quick brawl erupts with the WCW trio getting the advantage.
Quite a lot of gorilla pressing in this pay-per-view.
Yeah, there is.
The crowd barks for Rick Steiner.
Mm. They always do.
Savage hides behind Elizabeth, so Scott Steiner picks her up and moves her out the way.
I like that.
Picks her up in the same way that I'd pick up like a four-year-old and shift them around.
Scott Norton tags in and so does Rick Steiner. Rick hits a suplex and a clothesline, followed by a power slam for a two count. Ray Traylor tags in and continues the attack to Norton, who pushes Traylor into the NWO corner for a tag to Vincent. Quickly, Traylor hits a spinebuster and Vincent hits, well, not a lot, mostly punches and kicks.
Hmm.
Does anyone else think that Ray Traylor doesn't really have any support from the crowd? He's been involved in a fair bit of storyline.
Yeah.
Former NWO, who's now out on his own and is being victimised by them. But to me, it just doesn't seem to be that the crowd just didn't care.
Well, the storyline is not that he turned on them to go back to WCW, more that they booted him out and now he's on his own.
But he has this kind of this running storyline that's been on TV, and so people will know about it, but no one seems to care what he's doing.
Traylor hits a side slam and tags Scott Steiner in. Scott hits a whopper of a belly-to-belly suplex and paintbrushes Vincent around the face before tagging Traylor back in.
Nice.
Traylor with a scoop slam and a knee to Vincent before Rick Steiner comes back in. Steiner aggressively applies a chin lock and glares at the NWO members on the apron. Traylor tags back in and misses a splash to Vincent, who tags Norton. Norton with a big clothesline and punches to Traylor in the corner, with Savage assisting from the apron. Vincent comes back in and he and Traylor just quickly do a double down. Traylor makes the tag to Rick Steiner, who takes all the NWO guys down, hitting scoop slams to Savage and Vincent before a backdrop to Norton. The Steiners set Vincent up on Rick's shoulders, and Scott hits a DDT from the top rope to a reaction.
What's the most dangerous move we could do? Off the shoulder, top rope DDT? Yeah, let's do that. Vincent?
In fairness to them, I thought they actually executed it relatively well.
Yeah, but there's so much potential to kill someone.
It's not a move I'm sure you should be busting out too often.
It's like saying, I'm going to stab you, but I'm going to do it really safely.
Yeah.
Is it why Vincent's in this match?
I presume so.
They can't do it on Norton, he's too big, and Savage ain't stupid enough to take that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of the kind of the harsher moves I do believe he absorbs.
Norton breaks up the ensuing pin. As brawls erupt on the outside, Scott Steiner hits a Frankensteiner from the top rope, but Savage breaks up the pin attempt. Steiner hits a huge overhead suplex to Savage and looks to set up the Macho Man for a Frankensteiner, but Scott Norton removes him from the top with an electric chair drop.
Yeah.
Randy Savage hits the big elbow from the top rope for the three count on Scott Steiner at 11:06. Savage argues with the WCW guys in the crowd, again on his way out.
To be fair, there's some good spots in the match, but it just didn't really flow for me.
I didn't mind it. I thought it was all right. I always enjoy Scott Steiner's superpower moves. That's always good fun. Macho Man's always good fun. I've got to say, I quite like Scott Norton.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think he's pretty cool. I don't really like Vincent. I don't think he's a good wrestler or a good character. Or probably not a good head of security either. And I don't really know why he's in this match. But I guess it is to absorb lots of the punishing moves.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for the big boss man because he's doing something, but it's not really working. So it does feel a bit cobbled together but there was enough in it that I quite enjoyed.
Do you know what? I've seen worse six-man tags, mostly because I've seen the DOA versus Los Barrios. But that's beside the point. It didn't overstay its welcome, and there were some decent spots courtesy of anyone with the surname Steiner. So, overall, not good, but not bad. Randy Savage definitely felt totally out of place in this match, though. It's way too far down the card and far too unimportant about for him to be participating in.
So was he there simply because Conan couldn't be?
Yeah, he's there as a replacement for Conan.
If that hadn't happened, what was Randy Savage's spot on this pay-per-view?
Presumably he wasn't on it.
Well,
it's just ridiculous. Some of the talent that they've got that they're not making good use of. They've got
so many people, they just can't have even half the roster appear on like a massive pay-per-view.
Oh, it's not even a third.
Yeah.
Yeah, he should never be tagging with Vincent, who did precisely nothing in his combined 73 seconds in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, you know what they could have done? They should just have a big battle royal.
They had that last month.
Did they?
Yeah, World War III.
60 people.
Yeah.
Well, have another one.
I just love that they've got a roster where you could have 60 people in a battle royal.
So when I said Macho Man was a late replacement in the bout, his participation came with a set of demands. He wanted his team to win the match, despite the fact the Steiners and Ray Traylor were set to prevail.
Mm.
So, yeah, we haven't mentioned him, but Savage also holds an awful lot of weight, I suppose.
Acquiescing to Savage apparently greatly angered Scott Steiner,
oh,
who is said to have had words with Booker Terry Taylor about the change, and despite being allowed to get in a bunch of big moves at the end, he still wasn't happy about it.
Mm.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to piss off Scott Steiner.
Understandably, you wouldn't be happy about it if you're kind of like, this is what's going to happen. So, oh no, somebody else comes in and just changes everything. Yeah, you won't be happy. I kind of think he's justified in not being happy.
What actually happens to Steiner once he sort of becomes Big Papa Pump and shoots up the card? Does he become that same sort of character who just refuses to lose to people?
Well, he just beats up people backstage if he wants to.
Yeah, we know that he does that. Okay, so complete unhinged lunatic that will kill someone for saying even the slightest thing against him. But in terms of like the matches, does he take on that type of character that he's been used to working under?
I don't know, if I'm perfectly honest.
Or does he just think, I'll take it in a different direction. But I won't demand I'm going to win it, but people won't lose to me because I'll kill them if they do.
And yes, and if you say something bad about me when I do have a match with you, I'm just going to kick you full pelt in the balls.
Yeah. Poor Buff Bagwell.
The chairman of WCW's executive committee, Mr. J.J. Dillon, and Mr. Chairman, I want to bring you in with one thing in mind. I mentioned regarding the hotline tonight, a lot of rank and file. J.J., these are people that are not scheduled to be here, but yet they're here apparently representing WCW. Can you clear the air?
Gene, as I've looked through the ranks of some 24,000 people here tonight, I've seen virtually every wrestler under contract to WCW. I think it's a tremendous showing of unity. WCW has a lot at stake tonight. Nitro's on the line, the big match between the legend Larry Zbyszko and Eric Bischoff. And also there's just a tremendous amount of interest in this match that we've all waited a year and a half for. And one of the matters that needed to be cleared up was who is going to be the referee. And Sting, waiting a year and a half for this match, obviously wants to know that he's going to get a fair shake. Hulk Hogan, Hollywood Hogan, the reigning champion, he's got an interest in who the referee is. And it seemed like the only fair thing to do was to take the names of all the referees, put them in a hat, have a drawing. I've done that with the members of the executive committee observing, and the name that was picked out who will be the referee for tonight's main event is Nick Patrick.
Whoa, wait a minute. J.J. Dillon, in all due respect, that is going to raise a lot of eyebrows.
Now, wait a minute. Nick Patrick is duly licensed. He's an excellent referee, and since his reinstatement, I can find no criticism whatsoever with any of the matches he's officiated. So he will be the referee for the main event tonight, and it is official.
Well, I guess that's the politically right thing to do, I guess, in this political environment. Nick Patrick to be the referee in the greatest title bout of all time between Hollywood Hulk Hogan from the NWO and tonight, here at Starrcade, the return of Sting after a long, long absence. Needless to say, a very exciting night. Gentlemen, let's get back to you, Tony, back at the broadcast booth.
Mean Gene Okerlund brings out the chairman of WCW's executive committee, Mr. J.J. Dillon.
Right. Do you know who Reg Holdsworth is?
Reg Holdsworth? Is that someone from Coronation Street?
It is somebody from Coronation Street. He very much reminds me of J.J. Dillon. I think whoever the actor's name is, I think it might be John Morley or something. I think he went on to have a stint as a double glazing advert chap.
Yes, I think I remember that advert with him in, yeah.
So, were you so down on this pay-per-view that you just turned this into a game of who looks like who from soaps?
No, just struck me that he came on and thought, oh my God, that's a blast from the past. To be fair, he'd probably be in a similar time to whatever the actor's chap would have been on television.
Good sentence.
Who's your best soap impression?
I don't really know.
Who was that?
I think that was another character on Coronation Street. My mum and dad used to watch Coronation Street every time it was on.
You were doing one for us earlier before we started recording.
Was I?
Yeah, what's your Danny Dyer impression?
Oh, Malcolm.
I don't think that sounds anything like Danny Dyer.
I can't really think what Danny Dyer sounds like, but I'm guessing it's not quite that.
I quite like J.J. Dillon, to be fair. He's way better than Sergeant Slaughter. Like, he looks like a chairman of a committee.
He does look like he is genuinely just somebody who should be in the office.
Yeah.
I'll give him that.
He's better than Jack Tunney.
Yeah, totally. And probably not gambling all the profits away.
I mean, why, for this next bit, why didn't they actually do the draw so people could see it?
because it wasn't random.
But you know what? You could have a hat with names in, and they could all be the same name, Adam, if you wanted to guarantee it. Like, it just didn't make any sense. So why come out and announce it rather than... Because you could have made a segment out of this and broken up the card.
Tedium. You could have done like Miss NWO with a Mr. Referee. And then people could... The audience could kind of cheer us who they thought was the best.
Well, after plugging the hotline, Dillon and Oakland suggest that the WCW wrestlers in the crowd is a great show of unity for WCW. Paying for their tickets might have been a great show of unity. Dillon says the only fair thing to do to decide the referee for the main event was to pull names out of a hat and pick one out, and they've picked Nick Patrick.
Shock horror.
I dispute that. I don't think that was the only fair thing to do.
Yeah, I think it would have probably been fair to interview.
I think a fairer thing would be we're going to put everyone's name in the hat, apart from the guy that has an affiliation with the NWO previously.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Because everyone else is fairly... You know, clean running. We know they've got no bias anywhere. But this guy has. So we'll just take him out of the running.
But they do talk about his record since turning back to WCW as having been exemplary.
Is it?
We don't see this drawing, as Paul rightly pointed out. Dillon just tells us that the name was picked. Should do that with a general election.
Yeah.
The winner is Theresa May.
I can happily announce that I won the national lottery tonight.
I picked the balls out of a hat backstage and you just...
and there were 6, 14, 27, 41, 42 and 43.
And you just have to take my word for it.
Yes. The ball machine was Guinevere. Set of balls number 2.
When was the last time you watched a lottery draw?
I haven't...
Some eyebrows will be raised by this, but JJ says, nah, it's fine. It's probably fine. Please ignore the angle a few weeks earlier that was filmed for WCW Saturday Night where Nick Patrick turned heel and joined the NWO again.
But
we
what?
We cut that and it never made TV. So,
say that again, please.
So a few weeks prior to this, they did another Nick Patrick heel turn where he joined the NWO. It was during a Ray trailer match, I think. And they ended up just cutting it and not showing it on TV.
Unbelievable.
Whose side is he on?
Well, I don't know. It's the same. It's like if Skeletor had made friends with He-Man for a few months, you wouldn't just think that he'd forgotten his evil ways.
Have you seen that advert with Skeletor?
I'm not sure how I feel about that.
I was going to say, you either really like it or really hate it.
Yeah, I think it upsets me.
Okay.
All the time in wrestling, people just believe other people who were like bashing them in the head with a sledgehammer a few weeks previously.
True.
Up next, it's Steve Mongo McMichael versus Goldberg.
Excellent stuff.
With Bill Goldberg getting in Mongo's face after his bout with Alex Wright at Halloween Havoc, Mongo returned the favour on the following night's October 27th Nitro when he attacked Goldberg prior to Big Bill's match with Disco Inferno. I don't think that would have gone well for Disco Inferno.
Mm. Well, you never know.
WCW security quickly broke their brawl up. It would be Goldberg's turn to get one up on Mongo the following week when he distracted McMichael, causing Mongo to lose to Ray Traylor on the November 3rd Nitro. McMichael and Goldberg would be set for a match at World War III on November 23rd, but when the time came for the bout, Goldberg did not appear as scheduled. The cameras cut backstage to show Goldberg laid out on the floor, presumably injured in some sort of attack, though in reality, Goldberg missed the bout due to a groin injury. Mongo would make an open challenge with his ex-wife Deborah's newest charge, Alex Wright, accepting. Mongo would pick up the win with a tombstone. After beating the Barbarian on the December 8th Nitro, Mongo would be scheduled to face Meng on the December 15th show, but before McMichael could make it to the ring, he was laid out by Goldberg in the back, returning the favour from World War III. Kindly, Goldberg offered to take Mongo's place in the match, but Mongo made a quick recovery, legging it down the aisle to engage in a pull-apart brawl with Goldberg, meaning Meng never got to face anybody, which I'm sure he was sad about.
Mm.
Mongo would get his match with Meng on the go-home December 22nd Nitro, with McMichael picking up the win via tombstone. The go-home angle for this one would occur the night prior on the December 27th episode of Saturday Night, following Goldberg beating the Renegade after 19 seconds following a jackhammer.
Is he still a thing?
Yeah.
Wow.
After demolishing the former TV champion, Goldberg grabbed a mic and challenged Mongo to face him there and then. McMichael answered the call, but quickly the pair were pulled apart by WCW security. Goldberg makes his entrance as the announcers discuss the announcement of Nick Patrick as the referee for the main event. Raven's flock are shown in the crowd as Steve Mongo McMichael makes his entrance, having stolen the Four Horsemen theme since the group's dissolution.
Yeah, because I wasn't really aware that they'd properly split up, because Mongo still comes out with the Four Horsemen theme, so I just assumed it was still something going on.
I think he's supposed to be a face as well, but he gets booed. Goldberg's still sort of a heel.
Is Mongo that sort of character that will get cheered if he's in the right place?
Yeah, but I definitely think he's supposed to be a face.
Mm. Okay.
But yeah, there are certainly towns that like him, and I guess this just isn't one of them.
Yeah.
Goldberg walks down the aisle to meet Mongo, and the two brawl before the bell rings. Goldberg's offense certainly looks a lot more intense than Mongo's.
Yes. Mm.
Goldberg carries Mongo and puts him in the ring before leaning a table up against the corner of the ring. Mongo attacks Goldberg as he gets inside and the bell rings. Goldberg chants faintly from the crowd. Mongo hits an awful side slam for a two count.
Was it better or worse than the interrogators?
It might have been worse.
Wow.
Tony talks about Mongo and Goldberg getting it on in the dressing room.
That's an unpleasant image.
Goldberg hits a shoulder block for a two count and throws Mongo to the outside. Goldberg looks to smash Mongo's face into the propped up table, but Mongo blocks and they head back inside. Mongo looks for a flying nothing off the top, but Goldberg catches him with a shot to the gut. Goldberg rolls Mongo through clumsily for some sort of leg bar. Goldberg hits an awful spear, but Mongo kicks out at two.
My note at this point is this is tedious. And the crowd aren't watching. There's stuff going on in the crowd.
Yeah,
I think it's not just for this match, to be fair, but this is the first time I really noticed it.
Goldberg drop kicks Mongo to the outside. And foolishly, and this is gold, Mongo decides to climb back into the ring in front of where the table is set up. So he gets thrown out on one side, walks around and thinks, yeah, I should probably climb up directly in front of this table.
He's smart.
And then just stands there for a bit.
Well, Goldberg has a good laugh at it.
Funnily enough, Goldberg punches Mongo in the head and he casually falls backwards through the table.
I think it might be the softest table spot I've seen.
Like, it really wasn't worth it.
Yeah. It's like if I stood on the apron and then just tentatively just dropped myself onto a table.
You might as well have had a mattress there.
It gets very little reaction apart from a few fans trying to chant ECW.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. Absolutely. Like, it is the worst table spot I think I've ever seen.
Goldberg rolls Mongo into the ring and Mongo makes a fight back. No sell that table spot, baby.
Yeah, I'm thinking that Mongo actually has too much offence in this match.
He looks for the tombstone, but just drops Goldberg to the mat, but at least tries to sell his back afterwards.
Mm. Yeah.
He does a shit job of it, but he at least tries to
do
it.
So do you think he was legit trying to do it, or that was a plan that he couldn't do it on a guy that size?
I think it was a planned spot, but the way he did it made it look like he just dropped him.
Yeah.
Goldberg just about manages to jackhammer Mongo for the three count at 5:59.
That said, it wasn't a good one.
Post-match, Mike Tenay mentions that Goldberg is still undefeated, and there's not many WCW wrestlers that can say that. Tony declares that this is, let's say, chapter four in a long and drawn-out story between Goldberg and Mongo.
Why chapter four?
Yeah, and why describe it as long and drawn-out?
Would you buy the big book of Mongo and Goldberg?
Maybe.
Okay. I would if it was long and drawn-out.
You'd feel like you're getting value for money.
Hmm. Wasn't great. And I think that it does what Goldberg needs doing, if that makes any sort of sense. I take it he's still very good at having a match with Alex Wright and killing him, and maybe having a match with Disco Inferno and beating him, and that sort of basically just ploughing over people. And not only is he finding it difficult to do some of his really big power moves on someone the size of Mongo, but Mongo also gets a significant amount of offence in this. And does it do the right thing for Goldberg's character at this point?
Well, it makes nobody look good.
Yeah.
But at some point, you've got to put him up against people that present some kind of challenge.
Is Mongo the right person?
Probably not.
Mm. Now, we all know that I'm a big fan of Mongo.
Yeah, oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, but I'm just not sure he was right in this match.
The Wrestling Observer review of this match describes it as the deaf, dumb and blind leading the blind.
That's very accurate.
It certainly wasn't good, but I wasn't bored by it in any way.
It was nicely short.
Yeah, like it's way shorter than anything else on this show.
Yeah.
It was interesting, I thought, to see Goldberg so early on in his career. And I think we all, or well, definitely Adam and I, have a curious fascination with Mongo matches. So so when I saw that these two were facing off, it was like, okay, like, yeah, I'll watch that.
Would you watch it again?
Well, I did watch it twice because I watched it with him and then when I did my notes.
Would you watch it again?
Probably not.
No.
Smartly, it was kept pretty short and the right guy won. So this probably just about did what it was designed to do.
But like, there wasn't a dominance there that I think if you got a guy in a streak, it should have. And the fact that he, like with the jackhammer's a great move, but he didn't really execute it cleanly.
No.
I suppose that's the issue with a move like the jackhammer. You can't do it on just anyone.
Mm.
You can't jackhammer the giant.
Like, I think he does.
What?
I swear he does.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, what are the spots in that match? I mean, there's the table spot, but that's a bad spot. There's the jackhammer.
The drop tombstone and the crap side slam.
Yeah, so I mean, you can't count the tombstone because that isn't a move. That's a move that they try to do but don't. So you've got a poor side slam, a table spot that's probably one of the worst table spots ever done in professional wrestling. And
where the table actually broke.
Yeah. And then you've got the jackhammer that's just about possible.
Oh, he does crap spear as well.
It wasn't even... Yeah, it was a nothing spear, though. It wasn't like a full conviction spear.
No. One of these guys will rocket to the main event and the other one won't.
Is Mongo there until the end?
I won't spoil it for you which one that is. No, Mongo's not there until the end.
Aww.
I think he's gone by kind of mid-99.
Good sustained run, though.
Yeah, he had a good 3 years there.
I much preferred his commentary stuff with his little dog.
Up next is Chris Benoit versus Saturn in a Ravens Rules match.
Now, what does that mean?
No DQ.
Okay.
We saw the early stages of Ravens' WCW career back when we looked at Bash at the Beach in July and Nitro in August. His angle has pretty much stayed the same since then. He refused to sign a contract to wrestle for WCW for some time until World War III on November 23rd, when WCW executive James J. Dillon gave Raven an ultimatum. Basically, sign a contract at Nitro the following evening or piss off.
Did he phrase it like that?
Not so much, but that's the gist of it was.
Okay.
Raven finally put pen to paper when pushed by Dillon the next night, but claimed that he wouldn't conform to Dillon's rules and would only wrestle who he wanted, when he wanted, and only under no disqualification rules. That's some political power.
I guess so.
After leaving ECW with consent from Paul Heyman in August, Perry Saturn would make his televised debut for WCW on the October 6th episode of Nitro, appearing at ringside with fellow ECW alumni Raven during a bout between Alex Wright and Billy Kidman.
He would quickly see success in WCW, capturing the WCW television title from Disco Inferno on the November 10th Nitro. Saturn then faced off with former Four Horsemen Chris Benoit in his first title defence, when Saturn picked up the win as he held onto the middle rope during a pinfall attempt. When the pair continued fighting after the bell, other members of Raven's flock leapt to Saturn's aid. After a random attack by Fit Finlay, Raven joined his disciples in the ring to beat down Benoit. Benoit would be scheduled to face Raven on the November 24th Nitro, but after Dave Penza announced Raven's participation, Raven instead rolled flock member Sick Boy into the ring to face Benoit. With Benoit on the verge of victory, Raven sent the rest of his group to the ring, though Benoit would still manage to apply the crossface to Sick Boy for the tap out. After the bell, Saturn would apply the Rings of Saturn to Benoit whilst Raven watched on. The following week on the December 1st Nitro, Benoit would face another flock member, Kidman, whose gimmick at this point seems to be meth heroin addict in lieu of Raven.
He does look a bit junky.
Throughout the bout, Benoit challenged Raven to face him in the ring, with Raven remaining stony-faced seated in the crowd. After picking up the win, Benoit would do his best to fend off the flock until a distraction allowed Raven to hit a DDT, followed by Saturn applying the Rings of Saturn. The following week, on the December 8th Nitro, Benoit would again be scheduled to face Raven, though with Raven absent from the building, Benoit would pick up a victory over his follower Lodi instead, and post-match, the Crippler challenged Raven to face him like a man. Also on this episode, in a curious move, Saturn would drop the TV title back to the Disco Inferno, despite the fact Disco was pretty much constantly treated as a joke on WCW television. Yet again, the following week on December 15th, Benoit would face another member of the flock that wasn't Raven, this time picking up a win over Scotty Riggs, with Raven once again absent and the announcers speculating that the flock were lost without him. After the bout, Benoit challenged Raven to face him before diving onto the entire flock seated at ringside for a brawl and subsequent beatdown once the numbers game caught up with him. The go-home December 22nd Nitro would see Benoit scheduled to face Raven for the fifth time, however Hammer would enter the ring to face the Crippler. When the match spilled to the outside, Benoit slapped Saturn, who was seated front row, before fending off Kidman, Lodi and Riggs. Again, though Saturn would be able to apply the Rings of Saturn to Benoit as the referee called for the bell. The legitimate reason for Raven's absences would be an inflamed pancreas, which he still hasn't recovered from by the time of this pay-per-view, but WCW promoted the bout anyway, even though they knew he wouldn't be participating.
At least it hasn't burst.
Sounds painful.
Raven walks to the ring wearing a Dinosaur Jr. t-shirt to no music. Good band. They should have played some of their music.
They've got the money.
The announcers wonder where the flock are, which is weird, as we've already been shown them sitting in the crowd.
Maybe they've just gone to get popcorn.
I really like Raven's look.
Yeah,
it's kind of cool.
And I definitely remember like when I started watching again in 99, thinking like he looks like a badass, just the whole sort of grunge type look, which I guess was well done by 99, but still, I think it's pretty cool outfit.
He carries it off well.
When I signed a contract with World Championship Wrestling, I stated that I would not conform to their rules, that I would not conform to their corporate structure. I also made sure that certain stipulations were included, that I would be able to wrestle when I want, where I want, and who I want. And I've chosen tonight not to wrestle. I've also decided to allow Saturn to finish off something that should have been finished off a long time ago. The destruction of Chris Benoit. Quote the Raven, nevermore.
Raven grabs the microphone from Dave Penza and sits in the corner of the ring. He cuts a promo about not conforming and says he won't be wrestling tonight because he doesn't feel like it, but that Saturn will take his place in the match. Saturn enters to an irritating theme of air raid sirens.
Yeah.
What's going on with his hair?
Yeah, it's like a weird chunk of it just in the middle.
Yeah, I've got a sensible haircut and I'll just cut most of it off apart from this strange patch on the top of my head. Odd.
Between the sirens and his music, though, did you notice you could actually hear a pin drop?
Yeah.
Like no one cared.
Quote the Crippler no more.
I don't look at reality through any veil, nor do I see the truth through any veil. It is what it is. Things are as they are. And I am who I am. When I rest in reason.
Wow.
When I move with passion. And there's nothing I feel more passionate about than inflicting pain on the Raven.
Chris Benoit enters to a small pop. He decides to cut a promo, trying to be eccentric and enigmatic like Raven, and it really doesn't work, especially when he uses the tagline, quote the crippler, no more.
Mm. Yeah, he was never the greatest mic worker, was he?
Like, it was, I think, quite visibly nervous about speaking on the mic.
Yeah.
And he was trying to do it like so it rhymed, and it was quite cringy, I thought.
Yeah, there was a couple of words that he tripped over, and the tagline wasn't quite there. And it, like I say, it's just trying to be Raven, but...
He was trying to get it over with quickly as well. It's like he's trying to race through it. It's like, I know this isn't my strong point. I'm supposed to say this. I'll say it quickly and then I'll wrestle.
I get that they probably want him to improve that because that's obviously the part of his game that's lacking. But yeah, I don't know as if this did anyone any favours.
Mm.
Raven gets up on the apron and Saturn tries to attack Benoit from behind, but Benoit cuts him off and gets a shoulder block. Benoit tees off with chops on Saturn in the corner, but Saturn looks for a sleeper. Benoit jawbreakers out of it and rolls away before Saturn charges and Benoit shoves him into the corner for more chops. That was about the quickest thing on this entire pay-per-view, that probably, opening sequence?
Probably.
Benoit invites Raven to get in the ring and spits on him, but Raven doesn't even flinch. More big chops from Benoit before Saturn hits a stellar collar and elbow-style suplex to Benoit out of the corner.
I actually think that Saturn's really good in this. He does some really interesting moves. I think I've just kind of forgotten, you know, with all the mop fiasco, that actually Perry Saturn was really quite good.
Yeah, I do remember. My memory of Perry Saturn is very good, that I quite liked him.
He's way more agile than I think he's going to be.
Right.
He can do loads more.
But he's another one, I think, who packs even more muscle on, isn't he?
Well, by the time he gets to WWF, yeah, he looks quite grotesque.
They trade kicks and chops in a slightly jilted sequence before Benoit hits a dragon screw leg whip to Saturn. Billy Kidman jumps up on the apron, but Benoit quickly shoves him off. Saturn tries to clothesline himself and Benoit to the outside, but fucks it up and they just roll under the ropes. Benoit reverses an Irish whip into the railing and sends Saturn in instead before Sick Boy leaps over the barricade to take Benoit down. Kidman hits a shooting star press off the apron and scratches his face.
Well, he lands a little short, doesn't he? And then kind of hotches onto him.
Yeah, it's
a cool move.
Yeah, it's good and it looks really, really grand if he just, it's just hit, lands in the wrong place, doesn't it? Ever so slightly.
Raven stands over Benoit but doesn't attack. Back in the ring, and Saturn hits a leg drop to Benoit, who is suspended over the bottom rope. Kind of weird in that, like, Benoit has to hold himself up to take the move.
Mm.
So there's kind of a lack of believability there. Like, why would you just wait there holding yourself up? Saturn applies a chin lock as Mike Tenay confirms for us that this bout is being fought under Raven's rules. Saturn hits a neck breaker for a two and slams Benoit to the mat before running up the ropes and hitting a moonsault to Benoit, who gets his knees up.
Nice.
Saturn still gets a two count from it, randomly. Saturn hits a pair of big knees to Benoit's stomach, who sells expertly. Saturn with a leg drop for a two count. Saturn looks for a third knee, but Benoit rolls him up for a two count. Saturn lays Benoit out for a pair of two counts with a big clothesline before sitting on Benoit's back, wrenching on his chin. Saturn chokes Benoit over the ropes before hitting a brainbuster for another two. Another chin lock from Saturn as we see Mortis and Alex Wright just chilling in the crowd. And yeah, Tony tells us the wrestlers paid for their own airfare to be there. I'd be claiming that on expenses.
Yeah.
Benoit gets a sunset flip for a two and lays Saturn out with a clothesline. Benoit tees off with kicks, but Saturn rakes the eyes and goes back to chokes. Saturn hits a sit-out scoop slam.
Interesting.
And heads to the top rope, but Benoit cuts him off. Benoit shoves Saturn to the outside and looks for a baseball slide to the floor, but Saturn swats him away. As Benoit leaves the ring and is shoved to the side, he grabs Saturn and applies the crippler crossface on the ringside mats. The flock attack and batter Benoit, forcing him to release the hold.
It's a bit of a schmoz.
Saturn looks to moonsault onto Benoit, who is being held up by the flock. But Benoit moves and Saturn wipes out his own squad. Back in the ring, Benoit hits a big clothesline and a snap suplex. Benoit gets the biggest reaction of the match when he signals for the diving headbutt. He hits it, and again the flock attack. Raven gets in the ring, and the crowd pops as he faces off with Benoit, but before they can go at it, Hammer attacks from behind, and Raven hits Benoit with a DDT, which looks lovely.
Yeah.
He does always do a good DDT.
Yeah, very good.
And Benoit takes it very well.
Saturn applies the rings of Saturn, and the referee calls for the bell, giving Saturn the win at 10:50 to big boos from the crowd. For some reason, Dave Penza pronounces his name Saturn. The irritating siren sound plays again.
I'll be honest, the way that you describe that match, it sounds a lot more better than I remember it. A lot more better. My English is good today.
A lot more better. I struggle with these types of matches. And I think I've kind of pointed it out on the Sergeant Slaughter Triple H match as well. When you've just got other people loitering ground. So you've got a no DQ match, but it's not really one-on-one.
Yeah.
And in this, like, why would Benoit consent to this type of match where you've got like half a dozen wrestlers who are just running at any point and attack him?
Not only does he consent to it, but he consents to it on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
This is a weekly occurrence that he comes out, faces a member of the flock, and gets attacked by them. So it kind of makes him look like an idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, from what I remember of watching this, the crowd weren't, you know, it was the odd moment, but the crowd weren't particularly into it. There wasn't any heat for the match.
I think by this point in the card, the crowd had completely died off.
The other problem is, you know, we haven't really mentioned it yet, but the lack of promo packages before isn't helping me.
Yeah.
To kind of get excited for the match.
So I guess if you've watched all of the stuff that goes up to this, you know what's happening. If you've missed some of it, you're left a bit clueless.
And not even just promo packages, like interviews. Okay, we said Benoit had an interview and Raven did a little bit of talking, but, you know, we don't have those sort of Mean Gene style backstage.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Benoit, you've been attacked by Raven and his flock week after week, and tonight you finally get to face him. What's going to happen kind of thing that, yes, would bring you up to date in the storylines and would break the show up?
Yeah. Because you do get a bit kind of, even though there's lots of stalling, I'm a bit wrestled out because it's just match. I'm not getting any build-up and the crowd aren't particularly interested. And even though
they awake for the big spots. I've got this note later. Like, if something of note, i.e. a finisher or a confrontation they want to see happens, but for the actual bulk, the meat and potatoes of the matches, they just don't care.
Yeah, and it's... It's not like you get that kind of normal low-level buzz.
Yeah.
There's just nothing for lots of this show.
Would they have cared more if they'd have got Raven?
Yes, I think they would have.
And that was advertised, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what they thought they were getting. And maybe, actually, this sort of stuff works a lot better for TV than it does for live, because lots of it's about what's happening in that point in the crowd and... Yeah, I've got the commentary to back things up as you're actually watching it. Imagine watching this live. All you know is, well, that guy that I thought was going to be in this match, I wanted to see, isn't in it?
Yeah. And where's Kevin Nash?
And who's Perry Saturn?
It was okay, but it falls on the side of disappointing. I like the idea of Raven and Benoit as a feud because Raven can carry the microphone side of things and Benoit can carry the matches.
Yeah.
But the endless cycle of having him face flock members is getting a bit tiresome. Contrary to what you were saying earlier about Perry Saturn being better than you remember, I'm wondering if he's one of those guys who isn't as good as I remember.
All right.
Because there's definitely some clunky stuff in here and it definitely felt like his fault.
Hmm. Possibly, but he does some... I think it's the moonsault off the ropes and things. Things that I just never associated that type of style of wrestling with him. Yeah. So I must have just forgotten it because he became a kind of a comedy...
Yeah.
A spot by the end of his run in the WWE.
But we saw it was the Eliminators and the Dudley Boys at Barely Legal, wasn't it? And that was like 5 minutes of just the Eliminators killing the Dudley Boys with big spot after big spot. And then this was just kind of, The step-up moonsault thing was nice, but that was probably the best thing in the match. The crowd didn't react for the gang attack by the flock, and I wonder if that's because they see eight of those every episode.
Mm.
So yeah. not just the Flock, but the NWO. Like, there are multiple ones every single Nitro.
Is it, at the minute, is WCW, in your opinion, a bit too shenanigan heavy? And things just, it's always something interrupting matches or but it's loads of beatdowns. And
it's the same with the WWF, and that's just the way things are going.
Yeah.
Like,
there's very few clean finishes.
Very few clean finishes.
Lots of schmozzes.
Lots of schmozzes.
Is schmoz your new favourite word?
I'm just trying to use it.
Up next is Lex Luger versus Marcus Buff Bagwell.
Mm.
After remaining somewhat out of the spotlight for a couple of months, the total package Lex Luger began a feud with Buff Bagwell on the December 1st episode of Nitro, when the pair faced off in a singles bout. Luger would pick up the win via disqualification when NWO lackey Vincent interfered as Flexi Lexi got Buff up in the torture rack. Buff Bagwell would express how unimpressed he was with Lex Luger the following week on the December 8th Nitro, claiming that for 6 years, WCW had held him back and held him back and held him back in favour of the likes of Luger. Bagwell challenged Luger to another match later that night. The ensuing bout would see Bagwell get the win via countout, when Luger was distracted by Bagwell's vicious and delicious partner, Scott Norton, on the outside. The following week on the December 15th Nitro, Mean Gene Okerlund welcomed Lex Luger to the ring for an interview, but instead Buff Bagwell appeared. Gloating over his victories the previous 2 weeks, Bagwell said that Luger couldn't beat him, hadn't beat him, and wouldn't beat him. While Bagwell jabbered on, the total package appeared and challenged Bagwell to another match. Bagwell claimed there wasn't time to add a match to the card. Luger claimed he'd cleared it with the television people in the truck. Bagwell informed Luger there was no referee. Luger brought Nick Patrick out. Bagwell told Luger he hadn't stretched. Lex thought Buff might say that, so he smacked him in the face. For the third week in a row, though, there would be no clean finish, as Luger was disqualified for throwing Bagwell over the top rope, a rule that only gets brought up in WCW whenever it's convenient. Thankfully, there wouldn't be 4 weeks of Luger-Bagwell matches in a row, with the total package instead facing off with the Macho Man Randy Savage in the main event of NWO Monday Nitro, which we'll get to later. With Savage getting the pinfall win after Randy Anderson was bumped, Kevin Nash and Buff Bagwell attacked Luger before Macho Man dropped the elbow from the top rope for the three count. It's NWO B theme time again to bring us Buff Bagwell, who pretty much gets a nothing reaction.
I thought it'd be over as a heel for being such a colossal dickhead.
He does do a fantastic Lex Luger gag.
He does. Buff says that Lex Luger's new name is Lex Loser as he walks down the aisle.
That's pretty good. He probably read that off a sign at some point.
Oh, it's classic.
To be fair, as far as like irritating faces go, like if you tag-teamed Brian Christopher with Buff Bagwell, you might be onto something.
And again, like he takes an age to get to the ring.
I don't really understand. Is like Buff Bagwell isn't on the same sort of level as Lex Luger.
Correct.
Is this a concerted effort to pull him up to Lex Luger's level?
Correct.
Is Lex Luger the right person to pull someone up with his amazing ring presence and promo skills?
Incorrect.
Okay.
Someone holds up a jobber sign next to Buff, which pisses him off. The total package is out next, and his reactions have dwindled since his big title win in August. Lex walks to the ring looking genuinely like he doesn't want to be there, or he just doesn't realise the camera is showing his face.
I felt that he looked like he'd aged since we last saw him.
You said that. Yeah.
He looks considerably older, and I swear we only saw him in our timeline only a couple of months ago.
Oh, yeah, like 8 weeks ago.
Well, so. I don't know if it's his like hair or if he just looks tired or whatever, but he looks like a different man.
Yeah, the mullet looked limp and lifeless.
But watch it up until the point where his pyro goes off, like his face genuinely says, oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, he is going out for a pay-per-view match against Buff Bagwell.
He's thinking, how many of the 15 minutes can I kill?
Let's talk about the interesting skin colours on display here.
Yes, let's.
Lex is orange and Buff is red.
Yeah, he like crustacean red.
Bright red.
Yeah.
Like a lobster.
Yeah. It is that kind of colour, isn't it?
Do you think he's meant to be that way, or he's just gone in for a tan and stayed in too long?
He looks like he's got sunburn, I felt.
Maybe it's just his general skin tone. If you're of a darker tone, if you tan loads, you kind of go brown. So you end up looking a bit like Hulk Hogan, who looks like he's been creosoted. But if you're of a lighter complexion and you just try and tan loads, you probably do go a bit pink.
Buff takes his time getting in the ring, pissing Lex off. We start with a lockup and Lex gets the first advantage, backing Buff into the corner. The referee struggles to separate the pair. Lex spits in Buff's face, which is apparently so devastating he bumps for it.
Mm.
Maybe he just didn't spit saliva. Maybe he spat a ball bearing at him.
After another lockup, Buff knees Lex in the gut, so it's selling time for Lex, which involves plenty of... Oh!
You just make that noise. Oh!
Luger fights back with a scoop slam and a gorilla press, dropping Buff in the centre of the ring. When Buff gets to his feet, Lex clotheslines him to the outside. Bagwell checks his teeth on the floor and decides to call for Vincent, shouting his name three times.
Again, I have an issue with this, because if I was in the NWO, which is sizable, if I'm going to call for anyone, why am I calling for Vincent?
He's the head of security.
Yeah, but why wouldn't I just call for, like, Norton or Macho Man or...
anyone else.
Anyone else.
Like some sort of rubbish version of the Candyman, Vincent appears to provide Buff with moral support.
He says his name three times in the wrestling arena and he appears.
Vincent, Vincent, Vincent. Oh, shit, he's trying to sell me a picture with the Million Dollar Man that the Million Dollar Man isn't on. Back in the ring, and Bagwell takes the advantage before throwing Lex to the outside. Bagwell looks to ram Luger's face into the guardrail, but Lex blocks it, and Bagwell goes face first into the steel, and the ring post too for good measure. Back inside, and Vincent distracts the referee while Luger rides Bagwell on the ropes. Luger whips Bagwell into the corner and drills Vincent when he gets up on the apron again.
He did a lot of help.
Bagwell fights back, raking the eyes of Luger. Vincent chokes Luger while Bagwell distracts the referee. Nothing much happens for a while in this match, so I basically checked if Chelsea had won the Premier League yet. They hadn't, for the record, but by the end of this show they had. Bagwell says hello to Lex's mum for some reason. The crowd chant USA, and I have no idea why, because it's got nothing to do with what's going on in the ring.
I think they're just bored too. I mean, literally, I mean, you can see I've not turned my Kindle on for this match because I've written nothing of any note whatsoever for it.
I've not really written much about it. I've written that I really don't like Buff's tattoo.
What's his tattoo?
It's like a bit of a rope going around one of his arms.
Mm.
Luger gets a boot up on a Bagwell charge and hits a clothesline to no reaction, leaving both men down. Bagwell gets a two count off Luger's clothesline, which was odd. Bagwell goes back on the attack and applies a chin lock because this match has been all action. This is so boring. The cameras show a long shot of the ring for about 20 seconds and nothing happens.
You can imagine the director of the show just with his head in his hands to go, God, pull to a wide shot, quick.
Let's find a wrestler in the crowd.
Luger fights back eventually with a clothesline, but Bagwell cuts him off on a backdrop attempt. Luger gets a schoolboy for a two count, and Bagwell goes back to the chin lock. Tony talks about how this has been a well-wrestled match by Buff Bagwell. Yep, especially if you're a fan of chin locks.
It's a really good job that Bobby Heenan isn't actually on the commentary, otherwise he might have just lost it, pissing himself at that point.
Luger eventually gets some offense in, so Bagwell quickly applies a sleeper hold. Luger gets another comeback on a third arm drop and back suplexes Bagwell to no reaction. Bagwell goes for a splash, but Luger gets his knees up. Luger gets a back body drop and a trio of clotheslines which wake the crowd up.
Stuart, are we nearly there yet?
Luger hits an atomic drop and Bagwell dances around. Luger does another and Vincent gets up on the apron, so Luger knocks him off.
Is it much further?
Luger hits a forearm to Bagwell and the crowd react at the prospect of a torture rack. Luger hits a suplex as Vincent sneakily climbs to the top rope, so Luger lobs him onto Bagwell and whips the pair together. After disposing of Vincent, Luger gets into an argument with the referee, so Buff knees Luger in the back, who takes out the official. Luger hits a power slam and signals for the rack. He gets Bagwell up, but there's no referee to render a decision. Macho Man Randy Savage runs to the ring and frees Bagwell from the rack. Savage tries to pick Luger up, but Luger blocks it and hits a gorilla press slam to the Macho Man to a huge reaction.
It's a bit of a schmoz by this point, don't you think?
Luger signals it's time to rack Savage and does so. Scott Norton comes to the ring, casually gets in and kicks Luger in the abdomen. He hits Luger with some sort of chain around his fist, and Luger goes down. The announcers speculate that it's Rick Steiner's dog collar. How do they know it doesn't belong to an actual dog?
True.
Norton drags Bagwell on top of Luger before waking the referee up, Brock Lesnar style, to count the three for Bagwell at 16:36, rather than calling for the disqualification.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing. We talk about refs all the time being stupid, but I've been mildly concussed. I've just woken up, and I'm in midair. And Scott Norton is picking me up by one hand and dropping me next to Lex Luger, who is out cold. Yeah, this probably ended up all right. I'll probably just count it.
Scott Norton drags Bagwell out of the ring as Miss Elizabeth runs down the aisle, which is the best part of this entire segment, to help the Macho Man to his feet.
This saved the match because it was at least enjoyable.
Which bit?
Miss Elizabeth's running down the ramp.
Knew you were going to say that. Oh, my word. this... The way you've described this, I don't know how you do it, but you've made that sound like a five-star classic version of what it really was.
Because it cut out about 8 minutes of chin locks.
Oh, it was just... I don't actually remember anything happening apart from, like, the very final, perhaps 2 or 3 minutes, when it's kind of like interference, torture rack, blah-de-blah. Oh, but it was dull as you like. I wasn't impressed.
Yep. Bad match. Boring. Not good. Heatless.
It was like upsettingly bad.
Yeah.
Really bad. Yeah.
And only saved by Miss Elizabeth's Baywatch impression at the end.
Well, I've actually got exclusive for the show here. It's the conversation between Buff Bagwell and Lex Luger backstage prior to the match. Never heard before. So basically what happened was Buff goes up to Lex and is like, Lex, this is my big match. This is my chance to ascend to main event status. They've given us 16 and a half minutes. How do we fill minutes 2 to 14? And Lex responds, rest holds. Lots and lots of rest holds. Bagwell says, anything else? Luger says, nope, just rest holds. Oh. That's what happened, isn't it?
Nope.
Just chin locks and a sleep hold. Job done. Job's a good one.
This was not a good use of 16 minutes of my life.
But it's the thing is, like, Starrcade is their biggest show of the year, right?
In theory, yes.
And lots of eyes on it, particularly...
Most
eyes. So let's really kind of capitalise on this opportunity, folks. Like, what was Eric Bischoff thinking?
We've got a 16-minute match, all right? Who's a cardio monster? Lex Luger? Yep. Who else can work a good one? Buff Bagwell? Yep. That'll work. Put it on. You've got other people sitting. You've got loads of people sitting in the fucking audience.
Ultimo Dragon. Yeah. Bought a ticket. Yes.
This is like the ludicrosity of it. And I know that's not a word. But how? Like, they must have been sitting there seething with anger.
Even like Alex Wright would have been sitting there thinking, Jesus, I could do better than this.
They should have literally just jumped up, got in the ring, done some twirly stuff and saved it.
If someone had just hopped the barricade
and just started having just another match,
just said, this is shit, and then just had another match, that would have been better.
I guess if you want to look at what it's achieving or trying to achieve is, yes, it is trying to bring Buff Bagwell up and kind of take a guy who's a bit lower down the card and elevate him a bit further up the card, but it doesn't work.
Has Lex Luger ever demonstrated himself as being someone that can take a lower talent and raise them up to his game?
No.
He's not got that quality that Brett's got. And even Sean has that quality if he wants to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, there are people that are able to do this. Macho Man can do that.
Yeah.
Lex Luger he bemuses me with his reactions sometimes because he is so popular in some places, but doesn't seem to embody any of the qualities of a really top-line performer, apart from being big.
It's thoroughly inexplicable.
This was shite. But it was a 16-minute match between Buff Bagwell and Lex Luger, so what do you expect? Yes, I would have rather watched Miss Elizabeth run to and from the ring for 16 and a half minutes.
Oh, man. Or if they'd just taken that rundown shot and doing what they did with that Pixies video and super slow-mo'd it. So yes. Actually, from the top of the ramp to the ring took 16 minutes, I would have watched that.
Or just looped the same 10 seconds for 16 minutes.
We made a gif of this run.
Do you ever worry about yourselves, boys?
What?
No.
In what way?
That's kind of what you're dreaming up?
Or that I've found a healthy pair of knockers more exciting than Buff Bagwell versus Lex Luger. No, I'm not worried about that, actually. I'm fairly comfortable with it. Did you find Lex Luger and Buff Bagwell's 16-minute extravaganza more fun?
No.
All right, then. I'm glad we're clear on
but,
that.
But what I'm not doing is I'm not talking about super slow-moing down... A woman in a dress running to a wrestling ring to last for 16 minutes.
I'm not against the idea.
Yeah, seen worse ideas.
This portion of the New Generation Project podcast is brought to you by Valvoline, the number one choice of America's top mechanics. People who know use Valvoline.
Adam regularly uses Valvoline on all his moving parts.
Sorry, that advert's just on like every episode of Nitro.
Maybe we'll get a sponsorship from Valvoline.
can only hope.
We'll be sure to make good use of it.
You can use it the next time your car breaks down. Probably not on the tyre.
Or the brakes.
What is it?
It's a lubricant.
A lubricant. Yeah. Okay.
Up next is Curt Hennig versus Diamond Dallas Page for the WCW United States title. After US champion Curt Hennig seemingly wrapped up his feud with the Nature Boy Ric Flair at World War III on November 23rd, retaining his strap, he returned to the feud that began when he entered WCW. His conflict with Diamond Dallas Page, the man now being referred to as the People's Champion.
Mm.
The pair faced off with the US title on the line on the December 1st Nitro, with the match going to a, you guessed it, schmoz, when Ravishing Rick Rude pulled referee Randy Anderson out of the ring when Page had Hennig down. After the bout, the entire NWO ran out to beat DDP down, with Macho Man Randy Savage nailing Page with the US title belt and Hollywood Hogan hitting DDP with a pair of diabolically poor diamond cutters. Also worth mentioning during this bout was that referee Randy Anderson was hit in the head by a golf ball thrown by someone in the crowd and looked absolutely out of it for the second half of the match.
Have you ever been hit by a golf ball?
No. Have you?
Yeah, not in the head. I got hit on the leg once while I was playing golf, like... And then ball came in and it smarted.
It was curious then, a couple of weeks later on the December 15th Nitro, when during the NWO's show opening promo, Curt Hennig began referring to facing Ric Flair inside a steel cage at Starrcade for the US title. Even more curious was the fact that the Nature Boy was still injured at the time and clearly wouldn't be competing on December 28th. To compensate for this, Hennig challenged Flair to a match deep in the third hour of the December 15th Nitro held in North Carolina. Ric Flair country. Flair accepted and the match went a whopping 17 seconds when most of the NWO interfered. After comfortably holding the bulk of the group at bay for some time with shots to the balls, the Nature Boy succumbed to the numbers game with Hennig taking out Flair's knee. Fortunately for Flair, Diamond Dallas Page, Lex Luger and the Steiner brothers ran out to assist him, with Page taking possession of Curt Hennig's US title during a brawl and refusing to return it. As the rest of the WCW wrestlers helped Flair to the back, DDP challenged Hennig to come and fetch his strap, but when faced with the entirety of the NWO, Page escaped through the crowd. Kindly, DDP left the US title in the ring for Hennig to collect. DDP cut a promo on the Go Home December 22nd Nitro about how much he loved Christmas, claiming that there was a present waiting for him at Starrcade, Curt Hennig and the US title. Keen to repay the kindness, Page said he had a present for Hennig himself. For Hennig to feel the bang of a diamond cutter on December 28th. It's been literally 10 seconds since we've heard an NWO theme when it hits again to bring us the US champion Curt Hennig. Thankfully, Vincent isn't with him. Diamond Dallas Page sadly makes his entrance without Kimberly, but he does get a small amount of pyro.
Well, it's good, though, that we've got a pretty much promo to bring us up to speed.
Well, we've got not. Him.
Yeah, we've had it now, but I didn't have that last night. I've not got him on tap like you have.
Why don't you just text him?
Well,
give us a rundown of what's happening with this DDP thing.
I just watched Lex Luger against Buff Bagwell. I was lucky to be alive.
Mike Tenay says that Paige stepping in to take this match in the place of Ric Flair is another show of unity from WCW. Big DDP chants from the crowd. They lock up to open, but DDP quickly gets a schoolboy for a two count. I really liked that. Just out of nowhere, quick pin.
How would you have felt about it if he'd have won with that?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I think that would have been interesting.
Paige rings the arm of Hennig and looks for a diamond cutter quickly, but Hennig shoves him away and bails from the ring. Back inside, Hennig takes over with an eye poke and quickly goes to work on Paige's ribs with boots. Hennig looks for a sleeper hold, but Paige slips out of it and takes back over with a side headlock. Hennig gets a knee in the corner and some chops before Paige once again snaps Hennig over with a headlock. For some reason, completely out of nowhere, Dusty just says, "What about this? NSWO. Yeah. New Sting World Order."
The new Sting World Order.
That was cringe.
Well, Tony and Mike are keen to sign up.
Yeah, where can I sign? I want to be a part of it.
I guess they've got to. They can't say, "That's terrible, Dusty."
That is an awful idea.
Hennig bails from the ring again, and Paige follows to bring him back in. But Hennig snaps Paige neck first over the top rope. Hennig goes back to working on Paige's ribs, sending Paige tumbling to the outside. Hennig hits chops and shoves Paige into the steel steps, with DDP selling big time. Back inside again, and Hennig targets the ribs some more, standing on the small of Paige's back. Dusty uses the phrase, "dip the light fandango," which I'm pretty sure is just gibberish, and then goes on about looking all the way down the roster to the top.
Yeah, that made no sense.
Hennig runs through DDP with a clothesline for a two and applies a chin lock. Hennig attempts to use the ropes for leverage, but doesn't quite make it, even though the referee never catches him. We get another shot of the WCW guys in the crowd, and it was at this point that I noticed that Mortis's mask, which I love, makes it look like he has no chin whatsoever.
I think it's because it's completely black in that area, isn't it? So I guess if he's not in full lighting, he does look like the chinless man.
Paige hits a jawbreaker to escape the chinlock, and we get an awkward moment where Hennig goes to punch Paige from behind, but literally grazes the top of his head. Paige fires back with right hands, and the pair begin an exchange that ends with Paige hitting one and sending Hennig to the outside. Paige hits a nice dive over the top rope to Hennig on the floor.
Does it not strike you that, at least it did to me, that there really is no reaction for this match?
Up until a point.
But it's very quiet. You've got like a couple of people who are quite over. Right? DDP's done well for himself, but I just kind of got the impression that this crowd they're really waiting for the diamond cutter, and that's about it.
Well, my note fairly early on is I'm just waiting for the diamond cutter.
You'd have been good in this crowd.
Yeah.
Paige throws Hennig into the crowd before they head back inside. Paige grabs Hennig's legs and pulls him ball first into the corner post. Dusty asks if that was a Hurricane Rana or a Johnny Come Lately.
What?
What's a Johnny Come Lately?
I've no idea. Tony says they should call it Crunch Time, which is actually a pretty good name.
Yes, Crunch Time would be amazing.
The Nutcracker.
All that. Paige goes for the diamond cutter, but Hennig holds onto the rope and uses them for a two count. Paige gets a schoolboy for another two. Hennig goes for a fisherman's suplex, but Paige gets a small package for a two. Hennig gets a clothesline for a two. Hennig goes for the fisherman one more time, but DDP pulls Hennig to the mat in an armbar position.
That was nice.
They both go for a punch and fall to their feet. Hennig reverses an Irish whip, and when Paige rebounds off the ropes, he tornadoes around Hennig and hits the diamond cutter out of nowhere for the three count at 10:52 to a big pop.
I wasn't overly keen on this match. I quite like Mr. Perfect. I quite like Diamond Dallas Page. And I didn't think that they did things particularly badly, but the atmosphere of the match was very much lacking. And I don't know whether this is that I've been killed off by the Lex Bagwell fiasco, or whether I just didn't really enjoy it. I'm not sure.
It's a tough one. I don't know if you guys got the sense that I felt that they perhaps turned the mics up when the diamond cutter went off.
No, I think they just explode for it.
I mean, they do definitely explode, but it felt particularly loud. But, you know, definitely the last couple of minutes were pretty heated and kind of got a bit more of a reaction. But, yeah, overall, it's just missing something. Something isn't quite right about how this pay-per-view is going and what the crowd reactions are like and the quality of the matches. It's just all a bit off.
Mm. Yeah, this was the point where I made my note that says the crowd reacts for the big spots and literally nothing else.
Mm.
Like, the bulk of the matches, they just couldn't care less about. But when they get a sniff of a diamond cutter or a glimpse of a torture rack or Macho Man might go for an elbow, like, that's when they care.
Mm.
And some of the matches have had a decent amount of build. Like, the next one that we're going to has substantial build. But I almost wonder if the emphasis on Hogan Sting means actually, like, that is literally all everyone's waiting for.
Yeah.
It's too heavy-weighted in that one match.
Possibly. I mean, you can have main events that are the most hyped thing by a country mile on a show, but the undercard still draws a reaction. But,
yeah,
outside of the opener, which was obviously pretty decent, though not stellar, like, since then they've just gradually, and rightly so in Luger Bagwell, slipped into a coma.
Mm.
But, yeah, when there's a hint of something massive happening, they will wake up.
Yeah.
Page capturing the US title should be a big moment for him, but this kind of just doesn't feel like one. There's interference in just about everything NWO-related on this card. So if there's one match you'd want to tell that story of, like, someone overcoming the odds and triumphing against greater numbers, like, Page is the guy you do that with. Like, that's his deal.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you do it here? Instead, he just beats Hennig in a pretty flat match. I'm glad Hennig has lost the US title, as he shouldn't be holding the promotion's secondary title at this point. That said, I like the finish and DDP's various ways of avoiding the fisherman suplex.
Yeah.
Backstage, Eddie Guerrero offers hairstyle tips on WCWWrestling.com. I presume that's what he's talking about.
Grow the back of your hair and then grease it. That's probably his tip.
Is that also your tip?
What he does?
I wouldn't say, you've got to be a certain person to carry off the greasy mullet. He's got it working for his character at the minute. But I like it on Eddie. I wouldn't like it on many people. I much prefer the massively overinflated mullets of the late 1980s power ballad bands.
It's time for our semi-main event. Larry Zbysko versus Eric Bischoff, with Nitro on the line and special guest referee Bret the Hitman Hart.
Mm.
After Larry Zbysko's involvement in the Scott Hall Lex Luger match at Halloween Havoc, on the following night's October 27th Nitro, the living legend challenged Scott Hall to a match. Hall appeared and quickly rebuffed the offer, claiming that Larry couldn't even beat his boy Eazy-E. Scott Hall would repeat the sentiment the following week on November 3rd. After another couple of weeks of challenges, Eric Bischoff approached Larry Zbysko at the announce table towards the end of the first hour of the November 17th Nitro. After Bischoff seemingly backed down from Larry, the NWO B team of Scott Norton, Vincent, Buff Bagwell and Conan attacked Zbysko from behind and held him up to receive a big karate kick from Bischoff, eliminating Larry from the rest of the broadcast. After a pre-paid advert by the New World Order mocking Larry Zbysko aired on the November 24th Nitro, Zbysko marched to the ring and demanded Scott Hall come out. Instead, he received a shower of NWO leaflets depicting Bischoff standing over Larry at Halloween Havoc. Despite this, Zbysko refused to leave the ring, but instead of receiving the presence of Scott Hall, Eric Bischoff appeared. After running down Larry's wrestling and announcing career, Bischoff claimed that Hall was right. Zbysko couldn't even beat him. Tired of Eazy-E's constant gloating, Zbysko challenged Bischoff to face him instead of Hall. Despite feeling that Larry was too old and too fat, Bischoff seemingly accepted the challenge, though the pair would be held apart by WCW security guards to prevent any physicality. Eric Bischoff would open the December 1st episode of Nitro, being interviewed by Mean Gene Okerlund. Bischoff would try to back out of the match at Starrcade with Larry Zbysko, claiming that there was not a piece of paper in the WCW office that had his signature on agreeing to the match, and that a verbal contract was not binding, as the crowd pelted him with deafening chants of Larry. Bischoff, however, hinted that the only thing that could get him to agree to the match would be if somehow Nitro was on the line, but as Zbysko didn't have the power to make that wager, he wouldn't be agreeing to the bout.
Bischoff went so far as to tell the audience that if they were planning on ordering Starrcade to see him take on Zabisco, they should in fact not order the pay-per-view and save their money because the bout wasn't going to happen. Interesting marketing tactic.
Yeah, I saw that. Strange, like your head coming out and telling people not to buy the pay-per-view.
The old reverse psychology, isn't it?
Well, it apparently worked.
Yeah.
Later in the show, Gene interviewed WCW executive James J. Dillon, who admitted that Bischoff was right earlier in the show when he said that Larry Zbysko couldn't put Nitro on the line. But he could, and he was making the match for Starrcade. Eric Bischoff immediately appeared to challenge Dillon's ability to leverage Nitro in the match, with Dillon asserting that he did have the power and that at Starrcade he would revel in watching Larry kick Bischoff's ass. For possibly the first time ever, Eazy-E was speechless. Meanwhile, following the events of the 1997 Survivor Series, Eric Bischoff opened the November 10th episode of Nitro by bringing the entire NWO to the ring, carrying Canadian flags. After introducing the returning Kevin Nash, Bischoff casually dropped Bret Hart's name into conversation as being the newest member of the NWO, with announcers Tony Schiavone, Larry Zbysko and Mike Tenay in disbelief that Bischoff mentioned Hart's name, claiming that he would never become a member of the New World Order and that Hart stood for tradition. After complimenting Bret for being a knockout kind of guy, the NWO then butchered the Canadian national anthem to jeers from the crowd, apparently to impress Bret. And, of course, the next segment would be Mean Gene Okerlund encouraging people to call his hotline to find out about an alleged incident between Bret Hart and a rival promoter the previous evening in Montreal.
I wonder who.
The group would reiterate that Hart was joining them the following week on November 17th, this time with the addition of Ravishing Rick Rude encouraging Bret Hart to swim to the refuge of the NWO, as we discussed last episode. Outside of a promo where Ric Flair referenced him, it all went a bit quiet on the Bret Hart front until these two plot threads came together on the December 15th Nitro. As the announcers introduced the show, Tony Schiavone referenced that the Hitman, by this point they'd worked out that Bret Hart himself legally owned the name, was in the building whilst Larry Zbysko clarified the stakes of his match with Eric Bischoff at Starrcade. If Bischoff won, the NWO got Nitro, but if Zbysko won, he got his match with Scott Hall at Sold Out in January. Later on in the show, after a segment that contained a bizarre argument between Eric Bischoff and J.J. Dillon, where Bischoff insisted that punches, kicks and knockouts should count in his match with Zbysko, the pair's attention turned to who should officiate the big match at Starrcade. Dillon reminded Bischoff that he had acquiesced to every one of Eric's demands. Bischoff asked who would be refereeing the bout. Dillon suggested Randy Anderson. Bischoff said he was too fat and suggested Kevin Nash instead because he was tall.
Oh, good quality for a referee.
I mean, I don't know why they just didn't pick it out of a hat. Dillon vetoed that. Dillon suggested Scott Dickinson. Bischoff said he was also too fat and offered Six as an alternative, who due to a neck injury wouldn't be able to hurt anyone. Dillon vetoed that, and realising they were going around in circles somewhat, Dillon agreed for an NWO member to be the referee, as long as he could pick which NWO member that would be. Smugly, Bischoff agreed. Dillon's choice? Bret the Hitman Hart, who strolled to ringside for his first ever Nitro appearance. After Bischoff reminded Hart of the $7.5 million per year of Ted Turner's money the NWO were paying him, Hart didn't give much away with regards to where his allegiances lay, but he did tell Eazy-E not to look to him for help, as he knew better than anyone how it felt to be screwed by a referee.
Mm-hmm.
The go-home December 22nd episode of Nitro opened with a pre-taped promo from Eric Bischoff running down Larry Zbysko's achievements in wrestling, highlighting his own martial arts skills and thanking J.J. Dillon for allowing Bret the Hitman Hart to be the referee. At the end of the first hour of the show, getting slightly ahead of themselves, the NWO would hijack the broadcast position from Tony Schiavone, Larry Zbysko and Mike Tenay, deconstructing the set and replacing it with NWO Nitro logos. They also forced the cameramen and television producers to put on NWO t-shirts. Because this was an important plot point that needed to take up valuable time, this went on for close to half an hour of nothing.
Really?
I witnessed this while Stuart was watching it.
You watched Stuart watching it?
I watched it as Stuart was watching it.
Okay.
And I know that you'd watched literally about 12 hours or something of Nitro running up to this, but this was like the straw that broke the camel's back. I've never seen someone just destroyed by a wrestling program before.
Really?
Yeah, because it just goes on and on. It's hard. You should watch it. In fact, you know, just find this episode of Nitro and watch this in disbelief. You've got a full 5 minutes in this of Conan walking backstage into the production booth and shouting at people to put on NWO t-shirts. And you're thinking, why is this happening? It cuts back and it's just Rick Rude wandering around shouting NWO and throwing NWO t-shirts at people. And it is just the most surreal part of a wrestling show.
It's like some weird performance art. Or yeah. Like if you arrived 3 hours before the show and watched...
They've set it up.
The crew setting up, but they're putting it on the television show.
But do you think it's a clever ploy by the NWO to make them even more heelish? So this is what it would be like if we did win. You really don't want this kind of deal.
God knows.
I don't know, but it was pretty bad television.
Yeah, and there's no commentary because they've kicked like Shivani and all that out of the broadcast booth. There's no matches. There's no music. There's just the random NWO announcer every now and again just going, NWO. And laughing.
Yeah.
And it goes on.
You do occasionally get
on.
You get Buff Bagwell shouting Buff is the stuff and grabbing people's signs that are pro him and holding them up in the ring. That's probably the most interesting thing that happens.
For what it's worth, this segment would be a ratings disaster.
Good. Shocking.
Yeah.
With the programme losing close to an entire ratings point while all this was going on. It kind of made the swish new video opening they'd made for NWO Nitro, along with all the set accoutrements, a gigantic waste of money.
Yeah, How much would that have cost?
With Bischoff and company relearning a lesson they should have learnt in January with the debacle that was NWO sold out.
Yeah.
We'll discuss what all this built to, if anything, along with where Bret Hart fits in when we get to the main event. But obviously Nitro's on the line. They've invested all this money in new set stuff. They've made a brand new video that says NWO Nitro. Following this, Scott Hall continually appears in NWO Nitro t-shirts. At one point, clearly the plan was for Bischoff to win this match.
Mm.
And to completely shift the focus and rebrand the show.
Obviously, we won't get too much into it, but they've got Thunder launching in January, their secondary show, which is on Thursday. And there was very much contention as to which brand was going to take which show. This is what Eric Bischoff genuinely believes at the time. He thinks if he launches a second show where one show is NWO and one show is WCW, that will make the WWF the third biggest promotion in America.
Okay.
That's what he thinks.
Interesting.
And at some point, presumably in the week leading up to this match, after the ratings came out, following the Monday show, where everyone fucking turned off while they were doing this NWO Nitro bullshit, apparently this then gets changed.
Wow.
A piece of music that isn't one millionth as good as his WWF theme hits to bring us Bret the Hitman Hart, who hasn't bothered finding a referee's outfit for his refereeing gig.
Yeah, I expected him to at least wear the shirt.
Eric Bischoff gets his own theme, which is better than Bret's, for his entrance, and heads to the ring alongside Scott Hall. Bischoff has a leather jacket and a backwards cap on.
It looks pretty cool.
Larry Zbysko gets the Nitro theme for his entrance. He gets some pyro, which is presumably set to go off whenever that music hits. Mm. Like, you hear the Nitro theme, pyro goes off.
Like a reflex reaction.
Like a miniature Pink Floyd concert for £500.
Yeah.
Larry gets a big pop when he gets into the ring.
Yeah, super over it is Larry Zbysko.
And I know we sort of covered this at Halloween Havoc, but yeah, in terms of like WCW babyfaces that are over, I feel like it kind of goes Sting, Larry Zbysko, Ric Flair, DDP, The Giant, Lex Luger, everyone else. He's definitely second to Sting.
Yeah, why is that?
I don't know. Everyone's just really behind this announcer that really hates Eric Bischoff.
Is that more credit to Bischoff being so hateable?
Probably.
That now it's got Larry over?
Yeah, I think that might be something to do with it. Bret pats both guys down before the bout begins. Larry chants from the crowd. Bischoff connects with a punch and celebrates. Bischoff hits a second and celebrates again.
He is a prick.
Well, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Owen.
Weasley.
94.
Yeah.
WrestleMania 10, but not as good.
Well, obviously.
Is this actually like a martial arts thing where you have a pair of clown shoes with the soles cut off?
Yeah, I wondered this. Or is it something to make kicks sound good? Or
yeah, I don't mean to sound like really ignorant of what people wear for martial arts, but it just seems to me that it's a rather large pair of shoes that you've just sliced the soles off. I don't understand. Mm. If someone could clarify this for me.
Bischoff leaves the ring to confer with Scott Hall, who seemingly suggests the kick from The Karate Kid.
Yes.
He's like, Eric, I saw this film.
That's definitely the pose he does, right?
Larry won't have seen it.
Zbyszko connects with a couple of slaps and Bischoff backs away. Bischoff connects with a big kick to the side of Larry's head, taking Zbyszko down. Zbyszko charges Bischoff in the corner and wails away on him to a big reaction. Larry rubs Bischoff's face on the Starrcade logo on the mat, but Bret Hart drags him off. Zbyszko applies a sleeper hold, but Bret makes him release it.
Why?
Well, it's this thing to do with, is he NWO, is he not NWO?
So the idea is supposed to be kind of favouring Eric at this point.
Yeah, they've come out and said he's a member of the NWO, but then he hasn't really said anything. All he said is, don't look to me for help in this match. So, yeah, but then he came out in the NWO limo at the end of the Go Home Nitro.
It's all a bit nonsensical.
Zbyszko applies a head scissor, but again, Bret makes Larry break the hold and the pair have an argument. Larry hits a scoop slam to Eazy-E and applies a standing figure four, but Bischoff makes the ropes and bails to the outside. Larry follows and rams Bischoff into the steel post. Back in the ring, Bret admonishes Larry while Scott Hall helps Eric to his feet. Larry once again heads to the outside and rams Bischoff into the steel steps. Back inside, and before Larry can wail away on Bischoff in the corner, Bret Hart drags him away. As Larry reapproaches, Bischoff hits another big kick. Bischoff retains the advantage with kicks and punches to Larry, who struggles to his feet using the ropes. Bret doesn't break Bischoff's assault while the crowd chants Larry. Eventually, Bischoff tires, having punched himself out, and Larry fires back with a suplex. Larry hits a neckbreaker and scoops Bischoff up, dropping him in the Tree of Woe position. Before he can continue the assault, Bret drags Larry away. As he does, Scott Hall gets up on the apron and fishes something out of his underpants. And it is his underpants, that he places inside Bischoff's karate shoe thing. I don't know what to call it.
Yeah.
Bischoff goes to kick Larry with it, and it instantly flies out into the fourth row.
Yeah, it's just brilliant. I really hope that it was actually just silver painted polystyrene and not actually a block of metal, because it might have killed someone in the third row.
But the best part is, like, it flies out before it even connects with Larry. Bischoff celebrates to mega boos and starts talking to Bret. Just talking to him, just having a chat. So Bret lamps him.
Yeah. At this point, I'm very confused.
Well, wasn't he trying to hold his hand up like he'd won? Wasn't that the idea?
I don't know.
Because he goes to get his hand, doesn't he? And then hits him with his other hand.
Well, it gets a mega reaction.
Yeah, the crowd popped for it and it's big, but I just don't really understand.
Wait for it. Scott Hall gets in the ring. So Bret decks him too and applies the sharpshooter.
Yeah.
Zbyszko has a belt and just kind of chokes Bischoff with it for a bit. And for no apparent reason, and I mean no apparent reason, Bret declares Larry the winner at 11 minutes and 12 seconds. Mm. The crowd react like Larry has won, despite no kind of decision actually happening and no bell ringing. Tony is happy about retaining Nitro for WCW, not even querying how Larry has won the match.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Yeah, I know that the point has got to be that is Bret Hart NWO or not? And that's why he's doing all these things like stopping any of Zbyszko's moves, saying, oh no, that's a chokehold, that's the, you know. But this shenanigans at the end just leads me to believe that he's a bad officiator. He's bad at refereeing.
He doesn't understand the whole principle of a three count or a tap out.
Yes, and he just, when someone irritates him enough, he just batters them and their mate. Mm.
And it's weird.
And then awards the win with no pinfall or submission having taken place.
It's weird because it's just not at all Bret Hart.
Yeah.
So this is like he's being a completely different person.
Well, then that leads into my next question. What do you make of this as a way for Bret Hart to enter the promotion?
Not great, is it?
To be honest, it just makes him look like a bit of an idiot in that sense. Like, it's not his fault, but it's just random.
It's the thought that you've just come out of a screw job, everyone knows about it, so we're going to put you in your opening angle in a screwy ref sort of job.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But what's the point in that? If Earl Hebner had jumped ship, fair enough.
Mm.
But you got Bret Hart. Like, put him in a wrestling match.
Yeah, that's it. You and
have him save someone. Have him run out and save someone who's been beat up by the NWO. Have him start a feud with someone. He's a wrestler.
Yeah, this just was... You know, there's a bit of excitement. Certainly the crowd reacted for it. I can't deny that happened.
And they've got to use him somewhere on this pay-per-view, right? Like, they've just got him. They've got to use him somewhere. But I'm not sure this was the best use of him.
If you want any indication of what Brett felt about his participation in this match and his entry into WCW, we can go to his autobiography, which thankfully I get to use again. He actually writes very little about the whole thing, which in a 700-page book tells you what he thought. Quote, "Personally, I thought that appearing as a referee would be a lacklustre debut, but what did I know? What did I care? I wanted to comply, to do whatever was asked to the best of my ability, win, lose or draw, then pick up my check and come home safe. Nobody would ever accuse me of taking the business too seriously ever again."
So just given up then, effectively?
Yeah, pretty much.
Shame.
Isn't it surreal that you've got Bret Hart and Scott Hall, two of, you know, okay, Scott Hall's not greatest of all time, but pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And Bret Hart, we know how I feel about Bret Hart. And the two people wrestling are Larry Zbysko and Eric Bischoff.
Yeah.
It is a bit odd.
I mean, not to say that I don't think they could have a better match than this, but it wasn't a great match. It wasn't necessarily particularly exciting.
I mean, it's not a meshable sort of style, is it? Like, Bischoff does have kind of, was it like karate background or something like that. And like, Zbyszko's a big guy and a wrestler. And it's not a meshable style whatsoever. So that if you just let them to it, they're probably not going to have a great match. Although the crowd will fucking love Larry. So I guess you put these other things in to increase the interest in the match and allow it to go in a different direction. But it's a bit confusing.
I like the way that early on they say that a wrestler will always win.
Yeah, over a mixed martial artist.
Because mixed martial artists are always one kind of dimensional.
Yeah.
It's like, isn't that kind of the exact opposite of what's true in this?
Probably. I mean, I probably actually enjoyed the match itself more than you because I've watched the build. And for the most part, like, the build to this has actually been pretty good. Bar the NWO Nitro set, but anytime generally Larry cut a promo, like Larry's promos have been pretty good. Yeah. Bischoff is a Weasley cunt in the way that you want to see him get his face smashed in. So, yeah, like it wasn't the worst match I've ever seen, but the ending is just so random. Like, why can't Larry pin Bischoff? Is Bischoff that insecure that because all his mates won't get pinned, he doesn't want to get pinned?
You just lose, but you weren't pinned. It's fine.
And again, talking about the use of Bret and the use of other people on this card, like if you've got Bret Hart debuting and you want to get a big buy rate, and you know, you can't argue they've got a fucking big buy rate, but why not promote like Bret Savage as a match?
Yeah.
Or Bret Luger or Bret anyone who isn't Hogan and Sting because they're obviously going to face each other. Like
Bret Scott Hall. He's not doing anything apart from being beat up by the Giant.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know, and you could weave a really interesting angle in that and just like bring the whole Sean sort of click thing into it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you've got a really interesting storyline that people are going to really want to see. Mm.
Yeah, they could have done that as an angle, kind of like he jumped ship and is already being screwed by the click again.
Yeah.
And certainly kind of anybody with any inside knowledge would be interested in that.
And more to the point, like, does this make him look like just another pawn in the game between the NWO and WCW? Yes. So you might not necessarily want to do that. But if you're going to do that, then yeah, have them come out and say, yes, Bret is a member of the NWO. But then when he turns that down, he's turning it down because why would I side with Hall and Nash? Like, your pal up there did this to me.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got an interesting pre-made storyline almost. And it'd just work, I think.
And yeah, you could even use one of the WCW guys in kind of a better spot. Like, I don't know, Bret and the Giant against Hall and Nash as like, if you want to do like a tag deal as the first match. Like,
but again, we did talk about egos as well, in the case that maybe Hall and Nash don't particularly want to work with Bret.
Could be. Although,
or Bret doesn't want to work with them.
Yeah, or Bret doesn't want to work with them.
And Hogan doesn't want him in a super high profile spot when he comes in because Hogan might perceive him as a threat to his position in the company.
True. And for the most part, to this point, I think we can agree this is not a great show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but I don't like it.
Really?
We haven't picked up on that.
Everybody's here for the main event. So if the main event delivers...
Yeah, it'll be fine.
It's time for our main event. Hollywood Hulk Hogan versus Sting for the WCW World Heavyweight title. After the fiasco that was Age in the Cage at Halloween Havoc, Hollywood Hulk Hogan did that thing the following night on Nitro, where he just came out and made out like he won the match with Roddy Piper, even though he didn't.
Classic Hulk Hogan.
He also took plenty of time to promote his new Assault on Devil's Island film, premiering the following night on TNT.
Which looks blinding, by the way.
In an extra effort to get WCW fans to tune into the movie, Hogan and Eric Bischoff challenged Sting to show up at a press conference scheduled to coincide with the movie's premiere at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas to finally sign a contract for the pair to have a bout at Starrcade. I should mention it's premiere. I mean, it's showing on TV,
yeah,
and they're just having an event at the MGM.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not, you know, it's not a movie premiere. The press conference was actually taped a couple of nights prior to Halloween Havoc, but only 90 seconds actually ended up airing on television, 30 seconds prior to the movie and 60 seconds in a commercial break two-thirds of the way through the film. Needless to say, Bischoff was not happy about the small amount of time allocated for the angle by TNT. The press conference would see Hogan claim that Sting was too scared to turn up and sign a contract to face him before Sting appeared and signed the contract while staring Hogan down. On the November 10th Nitro, Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff opened the second hour of the show by stomping to the ring, upset that Sting was trying to break into Hollywood by starring in his own movie called The Real Reason Men Commit Crimes. No, I've never heard of it either. The pair then called Sting out to no response. I can understand Hogan's upset. Sting's movie has a 7.5 rating on IMDb, whilst the classic Assault on Devil's Island has a whopping 3.7.
Aha.
Not happy with appearing only twice on this show, Hogan and Bischoff also closed the programme to challenge Sting again. This time, however, the icon rappelled down from the ceiling and stood face to face with Hogan in the ring, dropping his baseball bat to do so. Obviously, the rest of the NWO instantly ran in and the group beat Sting down, with Hogan hitting a trio of leg drops as part of the attack. The following week on November 17th, the NWO would open the show, claiming that they had injured Sting and that he wouldn't be around anymore. Following Scott Hall's victory to win a WCW World title shot in the 60-man three-ring battle royal at World War III, which involved a 7-foot Sting interfering to assist Hollywood Hulk Hogan, who entered the match, by the way, a solid 15 minutes after everybody else did, the NWO opened the November 24th Nitro to gloat, with Hollywood Hogan offering to defend his title against anyone who had the guts to face him. The challenge was accepted by the Giant, who would almost have Hogan beaten in the main event of the show. What happened next was rather silly. Firstly, the 7-foot Sting reappeared, fooling absolutely nobody, and attacked the Giant's hand with a baseball bat, before revealing that, shockingly, he was in fact
Kevin Nash.
The rest of the NWO appeared to assist in a beatdown of the Giant. As they did, Sting fell from the ceiling and through the ring, so Nash beat him, or rather it, in the head with a baseball bat. The entire thing got no reaction, as NWO commentators Eric Bischoff and Rick Rude cackled about what a dummy Sting was.
What?
It was a dummy of Sting that came down from the ceiling and then fell through the ring until his head was just poking out. And then they laughed at it and hit it in the face with a baseball bat. This was...
So literally they chucked a dummy off the roof?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
It fell through the ring and then they battered it.
It was silly.
On the December 1st episode of Nitro, Hollywood Hogan and Eric Bischoff once again challenged Sting to appear, with the announced team speculating throughout the broadcast as to the whereabouts of the Stinger, wondering if he was massively injured following the assault nearly a month ago. Hogan claimed that the reason Sting wasn't around was because he was a coward and that he was afraid to admit that the Hulkster was the man who made wrestling. Hogan, angry at a number of fans in the crowd wearing Sting masks, then got into a verbal confrontation with a granny in the front row who took a swing at him.
Like legit?
Like an 80-year-old woman, yeah.
Brilliant. Did she win?
It didn't go to a match.
Thankfully, Hogan's not so egotistical that he'll batter an old lady.
Did she win, but later on he came out and pretended that he did?
Yeah, probably.
I think she gained the moral high ground.
During two separate matches on the December 8th Nitro, Conan versus Ray Trailer, and Randy Savage versus Hugh Morris, the lights in the arena would go out, and when they returned, Conan, Hugh Morris, and Savage were laid out in the ring, with the Macho Man decorated with a Sting mask. Following the show's main event between Diamond Dallas Page and Scott Hall, that ended with the usual NWO run-in, another Sting mannequin dropped from the ceiling and through the ring. When the NWO attempted to retrieve it from the hole in the canvas, they were shocked when the dummy Sting unmasked to reveal the real Sting.
What?
Where this angle truly came undone was when Sting couldn't. The harness he attached to himself from the mannequin became stuck, and the NWO just had to stand around and look shocked while he tried to undo it before having to fight around him once he gave up. Whoa. So yeah. The dummy falls from the ceiling.
So he's supposed to get the harness and then go back up.
And then they pick him up, and obviously he's attached to the harness that the dummy was. But then he can't unattach the harness.
Right, okay. Yeah, that does sound like a bit of a...
mistake.
Yes, a bit of a mistake.
Bit of a, like... There's some creativity and there's an idea, like a seed of an idea there, isn't there? But it's not a great idea.
After checking underneath the ring before the NWO show opening promo on the December 15th Nitro, Hollywood Hogan challenged Sting to come out and face him at some point in the broadcast. At the end of the show, following the Flair injury angle and DDP's challenge to Kurt Hennig that we covered earlier, the entire NWO came out and Hollywood Hogan gloated that Sting didn't appear to save Flair because he was a coward. Then the lights went out and a single spotlight showed Sting in the rafters. When the arena lights came back on, Hogan demanded Sting come to the ring. The lights went out again, and when they came back on a second time, Sting was stood on top of the Nitro entranceway. Shortly after this, the show went off the air, with Hogan still challenging Sting, who climbed down off the Nitro sign to come to the ring. For what was supposed to happen here, we'll go to the December 22nd edition of the Wrestling Observer. Quote, "The show ended with Sting charging the ring. The show was supposed to finish with the angle, which did take place in the building after the show ended, where Sting laid out every member of the NWO with Scorpion death drops, except Hogan and Bischoff, who escaped unscathed. Sting actually got a larger pop in Charlotte than Ric Flair. Because so many fans were hitting the ring, they ran out of time, and Sting didn't make it to the ring on time. When Bischoff in the ring realised the angle was blown, he, or someone else in the ring, very audibly swore, and then Bischoff totally freaked out in the ring, not realising that there was a live mic picking it up and it went over the air since there is no 7-second delay. He had his head in his hands when the camera came back on him after the swearing and acknowledgement that the entire angle was blown." End quote.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what you want to happen, is it?
Following the clearly expensive opening credits of NWO Monday Nitro on December 22nd, Eric Bischoff rode out on his super cool motorcycle and gave two motorbikes, 1,500 photocopies of a Christmas message, and an NWO-branded limousine, complete with hot tub and his own set of Nitro girls, to Hollywood Hogan as a Christmas present.
Yeah, this segment was unpleasant to watch because it's the kind of Bischoff loves Hogan type thing, and not only have I got you a motorcycle, Hogan, but close your eyes, I've got you another, and it's got your face on the tank. And that's not all. I've got you this, like, disgracefully stretched car with a jacuzzi in the back.
Sounds like a slightly grander DOA deal.
Yeah.
Again, more valuable use of television time. But this wasn't enough. Later on in the show, the entire NWO came out again so that Eric Bischoff could verbally fillet Hulk Hogan and give him more Christmas presents.
What did he get after this?
This time, presenting Hollywood with a ring that looked like his WCW World Heavyweight title. Eric Bischoff actually got down on his knee to present Hogan with the ring. No, I'm not kidding.
Hmm.
Wow.
Then Hogan presented Bischoff with a banner of his 1985 Sports Illustrated cover, claiming that Hogan was the only wrestler to ever grace the cover of the magazine, which wasn't true. Then Bischoff unveiled the banner of a still image of Hogan from his appearance in Rocky III. The fans booed this segment because they were so terribly, terribly bored.
Mm.
Like, how strange. I get the feeling this is really what Vince wants to do to Sean on Raw, but can't quite bring himself to do it. But Bischoff seems to be unrestrained.
Still not enough.
What?
Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff appeared in the show's main event segment to pretty decent heat from the crowd, which I imagine was at this point just because they wanted the pair to fuck off. After Bischoff and Hogan said they loved each other, again, not joking, one final present was brought into the ring, with Bischoff denying responsibility for it. After Bret Hart was shown leaping out of the NWO limo, which had backed out of the arena to pick him up, Hogan unwrapped the present, revealing his own severed head.
What?
Hogan did his best to act shocked and scared as Bret stood in the aisle before Sting was shown standing on the top of the Nitro set. The show went off the air as Sting rappelled into the squared circle whilst Hulk Hogan bailed.
His own severed head?
Yes, you heard.
Presumably he knew it wasn't his actual head.
Well, no, because he was looking at it.
He was aware that his actual head was on his neck.
Did he kind of do this like fake checking thing?
Where no, sadly he didn't. He just acted really shocked.
Were they trying to recreate that bit in The Empire Strikes Back where Luke has his visionary fight with Darth Vader and then it turns out when he cuts his head off, it's his own face?
I think they were trying to recreate that angle from Raw in 95 where Hakushi had a bag with Bret Hart's severed head in it.
Did we see that?
I saw it.
Okay.
There's your build.
I've got to say, I'm fascinated.
You know, it's good to get up to speed with the video package.
For all the praise the build to Hogan Sting gets on the macro level, which it certainly deserves, on the micro level, the week-to-week build isn't actually that good. And certainly, I'd say, in the last month or so, they dropped the ball somewhat. After a video package documenting the Sting and Hogan feud... No, just kidding.
No, because that would be useful.
We go straight to Michael Buffer, who couldn't sound any less interested in how important this match is. Surprisingly, Hollywood Hogan is the first to enter, and even more surprisingly, he's on his own.
I thought that was weird.
He gets booze, but it's not nuclear heat. As he poses, Hogan has a quick word with referee Nick Patrick. You spot that?
Yeah.
Sting gets a pretty cool pre-entrance deal with a weird light effect thing, thunder and lightning, and a preamble narrated by a small child that ends with, "This is Sting."
Yeah, I quite like this.
I thought that was absolutely stunningly done and then was completely underwhelmed when he actually came out.
Well, despite all the crazy rappelling from the ceiling and lights going out and appearing from nowhere and multiple Stings and... This time...
He just comes down the aisle.
He just has a gentle stroll.
Yeah, looking miserable. This looks dour.
He can't come out smiling.
I think that's the way his face paint is painted to make him look a bit sad.
It's like that bit in Frasier, isn't it? There's that episode called Boo where he dresses up as a clown and gives Martin a heart attack. And then they're in the hospital later and I was just like, look, you're still smiling. It's my face painting, you idiot. Not that Frasier was Alan Partridge.
I was pretty confident before this match came on, that he was going to kind of drop down from the ceiling. Because I thought that's what he does, right? That's cool. That's a big entrance. It's your biggest show. And then he didn't.
Do you know what would have been a good entrance, given that they've had 8 million fake Stings? Is, you know that Cena entrance at one of the Manias where there's all the John Cenas standing in the aisle? Like, it would have been awesome to just have, like, a load of Stings stood or, like, cut to random ones in the crowd and then the real one comes down from the ceiling.
Yeah, there's so many good ways that you could have done this.
Mm. Or just something that isn't just, I'm here, everybody, I walked
to
the ring.
And the lighting effect and the audio and the voiceover and stuff was really good.
Yeah.
Like, really well done. And then he just wanders out.
Yeah, I don't know about what you guys think, and I might be kind of just totally wrong in thinking this, but as soon as he came out, although there's clearly a reaction, for me, this actually didn't have a big match feel.
Yeah, and that's kind of written about in a few reviews I've read of this show from the time where it says, like, literally within seconds of Sting coming out, like, the aura they've spent 16 months building is just gone.
Yeah.
And why is that?
It might well be just because...
Is it his entrance?
He walks out, yeah.
So, because he's, like, they built up this almost supernatural...
Yeah, and then like,
thing,
human.
...thing about him, and then he's just a normal bloke when he comes out. Mm. It's really weird.
Tony tries to sell the story of what made Sting into this crow character, but this would have been better illustrated by a video package. Sting enters the ring and stares Hogan down. Hogan shoves Sting and throws his do-rag in Sting's face so Sting slaps him. Hogan takes time to jaw with the crowd as the match begins. They lock up, and Hogan backs Sting into the corner, but Sting counters an attack with a punch. Hogan sucks chants from the crowd.
Yeah, quite loud.
Hogan wants a test of strength, but boots Sting in the gut when he goes for it. Hogan punches Sting in the corner and hits a clothesline. Backrake by Hogan. Hogan goes for a trio of elbow drops, but Sting rolls out of the way each time.
Was it me, or did that look a bit silly?
It's a bit of a comedy spot, but I quite liked it.
But you're doing a comedy spot, because it is a comedy spot, you're right, in a match you've been building 18 months up to that's supposed to be like this massively heated feud.
Okay, fair point. Sting drop kicks Hogan to the outside, which the crowd pops for. Back inside, and Hogan grabs a headlock. Hogan gets a shoulder block, but Sting gets another pair of drop kicks to send Hogan outside once again.
Did you think Hogan oversold that a bit?
He oversells a lot of things.
Yeah, but this was, again, I think too much comedy. Because up to this point, Hogan, for me, has been a bit more physical in what he's been doing. Up until this point, he's doing it, you know, like we saw with kind of Taker. There was that match where there was just this noticeable kind of, he stepped it up a bit in terms of the physicality. To be fair, it kind of felt like Hogan tried to do that, which was at least to his credit. But this then kind of felt like you're reverting back to more cartoony elements.
Do you think this match was lacking like a really hot opening, like shine segment from Sting? Like, should this have began with Sting like absolutely going to town on him and Hogan only escaping by like, yeah, booting him in the balls or raking the eyes or something like that?
This has a really slow start to the match.
Well, it starts just with a couple of minutes of stalling.
Yeah, it's very, very slow. And in many ways, yeah, it should have had a really hot start to the match. And we've seen this in lots of the main events that we've actually watched, and Shawn Marks is particularly good at this, is that you have this like flying opening couple of minutes, full of moves, and you bail the other person to the outside after this flurry of attacks, and it wakes everyone up and kickstarts the entire thing, and then you can do some different stuff. But this just starts off slow.
I mean, this doesn't feel like Sting is trying to end an empire.
And more to the point, and I know we've criticised multiple NWO run-ins and blah, 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 blah. Where's the rest of the Empire in this super important match? Mm.
Yeah, where's Vincent? They were around
for fucking Buff Bagwell, but not this.
And at some point, I don't even know which one it is. Does one of them do a crotch chop? It might be Sting.
Yeah.
Is that me, or is that really weird?
Yeah, that's not his thing.
Yeah.
Hogan wastes time by arguing with fans at ringside. Back inside, and they lock up again with Sting grabbing a headlock. Hogan tries to shoot him off, but Sting holds on. Eventually, Hogan shoots him off and Sting gets a shoulder block, but Hogan fires back with a clothesline. Hogan hits a suplex, but Sting no-sells it and gets straight back up to a pop. Sting tees off on Hogan in the corner, but Hogan rakes the eyes and goes back on the attack. Hogan throws Sting to the outside and whacks Sting in the back with his own baseball bat. Hogan sends Sting shoulder first into the steel post before showing him, I think, a Hulk Hogan t-shirt, maybe an NWO one. Sting meekly sends Hogan into the steel railing, but Hogan moves on a Stinger splash attempt. Hogan crotches Sting on the railing and they head back inside. Hogan hits an atomic drop and chokes Sting with his boot. Hogan hits a big boot and a leg drop and pins Sting. Clean as a whistle. 1, 2, 3.
We're done, boys.
Yeah. And this was the really bizarre thing about it, because it's like, oh, he won.
It was out of nowhere, wasn't it? Completely out of nowhere. And Sting's really had very little offence in this match.
For some reason, Bret Hart is there, and he stops the timekeeper ringing the bell. Bret grabs a mic and says something about it's not going to happen again, before decking Nick Patrick. Hogan looks to bail, but Bret grabs him and rolls the champion back into the ring. The crowd react the biggest they have all night for this.
Yeah.
Hogan looks scared and Sting tees off on him before hitting a pair of Stinger splashes. Buff Bagwell and Scott Norton get in the ring, but Sting dispatches them. Sting applies the Scorpion Deathlock, and despite Hogan in no way submitting, tapping or saying he gives up, Bret Hart calls for the bell and the crowd pops big as Sting wins the bout and the WCW World Heavyweight title at 12:53. The ring fills up with WCW wrestlers who celebrate with the Stinger. End of show.
The general feeling from this that Bret screwed Hogan.
Yes.
Because Hogan had won clean. Wasn't a quick count.
No.
I can count to three. It wasn't a quick count. And then Hogan doesn't submit and Bret Hart has the bell run.
Again, this is not making Bret look good.
Does it make Sting look good?
No.
Who does it make look good?
Nobody. Absolutely nobody. Nick Patrick, no. I don't know.
Hulk Hogan won clean.
Well, Nick Patrick is the victim in this because he actually did a fair job. Think about it.
Yeah, he called it straight down the line.
He did.
Yeah. I mean, what a strange end to this massive feud and build.
And even after the shenanigans at the end, it's still only 12 minutes.
How bizarre.
So very clearly some shenanigans have occurred here.
So Nick Patrick was supposed to count fast.
And then doesn't.
But he just doesn't. He just does regular count.
So why doesn't he count fast?
In his autobiography, Controversy Creates Cash, Eric Bischoff details how he and Hogan disagreed over what the finish to the match should be for the first time in their relationship. Possibly because for the first time in their relationship, Bischoff wanted Hogan to lose clean.
Mm.
Bischoff says that Hogan never flat out told him what his issues with Sting were, but reading between the lines, he believes Hogan felt Sting was ill-prepared for the match. Bischoff says that Sting was clearly out of shape and looked like he hadn't seen a gym or tanning bed in 6 months. On the flip side, Bischoff says that he believes Sting didn't trust Hogan and that that lack of trust was probably well-founded. With Hogan having creative control of the outcome of his matches, Bischoff, like Vince McMahon the month before, was somewhat trapped in the middle. When Bischoff devised the fast count Bret Hart restart finish, Sting wasn't happy due to his win not being clean, but Bischoff felt he had devised an agreeable compromise. Of the ending to the bout, Bischoff says, quote, "The ending did not go the way it was supposed to. Literally millions of fans saw a count that was anything but quick. Replays made it pretty clear that Sting was legitimately counted out, which meant that the one that was screwed was Hogan, not Sting, and it undercut everything we'd been building towards. To this day, I'm not sure why Nick Patrick's count didn't go the way we planned. It may have been one of those things that just happens at a live event. I didn't think he had done it on purpose, as some people suggested. I would have fired him on the spot if I had. Quite frankly, the only thing I could do at that point was try to figure out a way to fix it the following day. We focused on the controversy. We replayed the tape of the count on Nitro and claimed Hogan had won to justify a rematch and keep interest in the storyline. But it was immensely controversial and put a bad spin on what should have been a wildly successful angle and pay-per-view." End quote. I think it's quite a naive view of events from Bischoff there, or perhaps one that just doesn't throw his longtime buddy Hogan under the bus, despite the fact that the book was published in late 2006.
So you think the word that Hogan has with Patrick is, "Count a normal count, brother"?
For what I believe probably happened, we'll go to the January 5th, 1998 edition of the Wrestling Observer. Quote, "After a lackluster match, which even saw boring chants 2 minutes in, Hogan delivered his foot to the face and leg drop finish. At this point, the plan was for Patrick to deliver a fast count and have Sting still kick out before three, but Patrick would rule it as a pin, leading to Bret Hart's avenging the wrong done to him at Survivor Series and getting the match restarted and taking over as ref, leading to Sting winning with a Scorpion submission in the middle. A funny thing happened. Patrick didn't count fast. You can mistime a ref bump. You can blow a move, but how do you blow a fast count? The only reasonable answer to this is Hogan changed the spot in the ring and Patrick didn't want to cross Hogan because of all the power he wields, even though the plan was different. Coming out of the Hart-Michaels deal, which has been the catalyst for everything in the business since, if Bischoff, Hogan and nobody else, perhaps Sting, decided to do a non-fast count when there was supposed to be a fast count as an angle, is your head spinning yet? But that doesn't make sense either, because why did they have the announcers sell it as a fast count the next day so hard when it wasn't? And if that was the case, the guy who got screwed and made a fool of would have been Hart, who, if anything, this company was trying to portray in that matter after the last company did. Sting did try to kick out, but Hogan didn't sell it by flying off, giving the first assumption some more validity. I'd say, coming in the wake of the Hart-Michaels deal, that the most likely scenario is that Hogan, who no doubt was negotiating for all he was worth as far as getting whatever he could out of doing the job, apparently was able to manipulate the finish into appearing that he actually won the match cleanly and was screwed by Hart, which wasn't the idea the fans were supposed to have. End quote.
Well, that's some good politicking.
Man, Hulk Hogan. But then, I guess, and if we think that he does just tell Patrick that there's a change to it in the ring, what's he supposed to think? I mean, he's Hulk Hogan. He basically runs the show.
Exactly.
And he says that it's been a slight change of plans, do a normal count. The fuck are you going to do?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is another position where you've just got somebody put in a really tough spot.
Yeah.
Because, like you say, you can't really blow a fast count, can you?
But it's different in the sense to Earl Hebner, in that Earl Hebner's asked to do something that is made out to him that, yeah, one of these guys doesn't know about. Presumably Hogan goes to Nick Patrick and says, yeah, we've just had a redo of the finish in the back, you need to do this.
Do you think this explains why Hogan is out first? I'm going out first, brother. Sting, you should have the main entrance. Because I don't want you in the ring while I'm telling Nick Patrick that we've changed the finish.
I don't know. I think the crowd has been waiting for Sting. I think it's actually fair enough that Sting comes out second here.
It makes sense, but in the world of Hulk Hogan, does it make sense that when he's the champion, he comes out after anyone?
It certainly gives him the opportunity to have that conversation with Nick Patrick.
Well, it's a very controversial time in the wrestling business, full of shenanigans.
More shenanigans than I thought was going on.
It's basically shooting yourself in the balls, though, this. You've got this awesome storyline. Everyone's invested in it. You've put so much into it as a company. Just follow it through. You're onto a winner. You'll sell millions.
And this is it. Like, the show's obviously wildly successful and does all this mega amount of money. And they're very much on high. And they'll go on to make a ton of money in 1998. But it's generally kind of considered that this show is kind of indicative of what will ultimately eat the company from the inside out. You've just got all these guys that can basically just go around and do what they want. Nash getting out of jobbing to the Giant by just not turning up. Yeah. Hogan changing the finish to a main event just on the fly.
Yeah, you can't run a business like that because like egos have to be kept in check.
The inmates are running the asylum.
Yeah, and I guess Bischoff is not Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
He cannot control these people.
Much bigger and more going on than I thought, I'll be fair.
I mean, it's a fascinating show to watch.
No, it's not.
No, it is. But for this story at the end, to see the payoff to all of this effort and see what actually happens. I didn't say it was an enjoyable show to watch. Okay. You're mistaking what I'm saying.
Okay.
Because most of it is...
awful.
I'd say moderate to bad. But actually what happens in the angle at the end of this is quite fascinating.
But the thing is, I didn't know about any of that watching the show. To me, it just comes off as a bad match. With a confusing finish. If I had, if I had Stuart on tap telling me all this as I'm watching it, I tell you what, I'm going to be much more excited to watch it. But until I get that feature of my network fixed, Stuart commentary.
Or until Mrs. Scrivens kicks you out.
Yeah.
And is this one of the problems, actually, with reading into pay-per-view buy rates at the time? They would have said, tip-top, massively successful, dead good. But the problem is, people don't order a pay-per-view, and then if the end of it was bad, they don't like then go knocking for their money.
Well, they just don't order the next one.
And take it. They don't order the next one, in which case they perceive that the build-up to the next one was wrong, not the fact that they'd screwed people in the previous one that they then chalk up to being a massive success. If there was a refund opportunity, which I know would just get exploited, but if there was that sort of thing, and enough people would have said, that was bad, I didn't like it, then actually you'd be able to draw something on the audience opinion from it. But as it stands, all they see is all the numbers go up, success.
Thoughts on the show overall then?
I don't think it was awful, okay? I think there was enough in there that I would put it on this sort of like lower moderate level.
Yeah.
I liked the opener. I didn't mind the six-man tag. That was all right. I was at least interested in the Bischoff-Zabisco stuff. The main event is not great, but it has a certain fascinating appeal to it. And then you've got other stuff that was god-awful. You know, so I think overall, for me, it kind of balances on this kind of middling to low sort of area.
I like it less than you do. I thought the opener was pretty good. I like the cinematic opening. Aside from that, there are some good spots in some of the matches, and the crowd do react for some of the spots in some of the matches, but overall, it's completely underwhelming, particularly considering that this is their kind of big stage for the year. The matches should have been better, particularly when you consider the personnel they've got. It should have been so much better. And for me, that's always the most galling thing when you get a show like this where you've got the people and you've got the means to put on a great show and you don't. It's not necessarily like at times when the WWF have got like a small roster and they haven't got a great depth of talent and they're struggling to put on a good show. Because you would. Here you've got all the talent, you've got all the opportunities, you've got all the money, you've got everything that you need to make a first-rate show and you don't manage to do it. And for me, I think that's why I have such a negative view. It's like a football team. I can't think of a good example right now. There probably is one where you've got like loads of brilliant individual players and they just don't gel as a team.
The English national team.
Well, possibly, but That's kind of how I see it. Just the things aren't coming together.
The entire piece isn't the sum of its parts.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm aiming for.
And you've got, if the show's being run by Bischoff, who, as we know, is relatively new into the business.
Well, not especially.
But, well, in terms of like, well, you've got Vince on one hand, you've got Bischoff on the other. He's new into the business. And he did things well, and he did things innovative, and he got things really on the uprise. But now he's not strong enough to control the people that he's put into these high-powered places. He's got these coups, he's signed these people, but he signed them without thinking about how powerful he's made them. And then he can't control what Hogan does, because Hogan has control. So he's kind of put himself, like, his success has eventually been his failure.
It's not awful in the same way that D-Generation X in your house was earlier on in the month, but it just doesn't feel as important or as monumental as it should do.
Yeah, it should feel like they sell it at the start, don't they, as the biggest wrestling event of all time.
To be fair, Tony Schiavone sells every Nitro as that, but go on.
And it should be, as far as a long-running storyline, and as far as like the star power that you've created to go into this, it should be a really, really big deal, but it underachieves on almost every level.
On several occasions, we've complimented WCW for putting on really strong undercards before the main event segments featuring the stars, but on this night, they didn't do the former anywhere near as well as they usually do.
Mm-hmm.
They still have the talent they had previously. In fact, they probably have more, but they just didn't seem to put them in matches that make the best of them on this night. Obviously, with a roster as big as they have, not everybody can make the show, but there's a ton of names that produced good undercard pay-per-view matches previously that aren't on the card. Zbyszko Bischoff is possibly the only match that over-delivered from an in-ring perspective. It could have been absolutely abysmal, but yes, it was only slightly bad. But the finish to that was so bizarre it negated what came before it. And after 16 months of build, Hogan-Sting is an abysmal match, punctuated by a tremendously botched finish that, no matter how much the announcers the next night on Nitro say it was a fast count, is clean as a whistle and makes Hulk Hogan the victim on two levels. It's worth watching because it's a monumental night in WCW history, but don't expect the strongest card. Make sure you skip Luger Bagwell, though, because it's shit.
Yes, it is boring and bad.
And 16 minutes. Fucking whose idea?
It's like King of the Ring 1993 all over again.
The thing is, though, it's really weird. Like, this show doesn't have, like you say, like interviews or segments or anything like that. But it doesn't actually feel like it's got that much wrestling on it either. Yeah. And I bet if you were to time the matches, they probably would only come to like a little over an hour.
Well, you've got, I think most of the matches are kind of 10 to 15 minutes, aren't they?
Yeah, or 10 to 12.
So what else is happening?
Taking
on
up
this?
The time, yeah.
What's
it's really
taking
weird.
Up the time?
I don't.
Is it replays of the matches that you've
possibly
just seen?
The NWO theme song?
Well, like, I think you've probably got about an hour and a half worth of matches would be my okay. estimate. So it's what, a 2 hour 40 minute pay per view?
Yeah.
So you've got like an hour and 10 of theme music.
Match of the night in MVP then.
No brainer for me really in the match of the night is the opener. The MVP I've not actually put down because I found it really hard to think of an MVP, but I'd probably have to give it to Guerrero for his stunning character work and actually appearing in a good match on this show.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, like I say, no brainer for opener. I'm racking brains to think of one. The only person that even comes to mind is Dean Malenko.
It's not even any kind of discussion on match of the night. As far as in-ring action goes, Lex Luger versus Buff Bagwell was light years ahead of anything. No, that's a typo. Eddie Guerrero versus Dean Malenko was light years ahead of anything else on this card. And it's not even anywhere near being their best match. That's the irony. Like,
yeah,
this is like middle of the road for those guys. But yeah, so much better than anything else. It's a real shame the likes of Rey Mysterio Jr., Juventud Guerrera, Psicosis, La Parca, Hector Garza, and all those guys don't make the show in any capacity, as I think you caught a couple of the tag matches on Nitro those guys had in the weeks leading up to this.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
La Parca dancing on chairs.
La Parca's dancing. That should be on every show.
MVP? Yeah, a tough one, as I don't think anybody had a stellar night. But I'm going to pick Scott Steiner for killing Vincent, which was pleasurable to watch. Like, he's so big. Like, and we didn't really talk about that in his match. Like, yeah, he's inflated even more.
I'd say this is almost the the genesis of Big Papa Pump. He's like proto Papa Pump.
Yeah.
At the minute, he's cut the hair. He's got the goatee. He's somehow, man, how'd you make the massive more massive? But he's managed to do it. He was muscled to fuck before, and he's got bigger. Interesting. Look, how long is it before he actually breaks into the singles? Is he still got a big run as a tag?
No, we're only a couple of months away from Big Papa Pump.
Wow.
And an award that, you know, last episode, struggling to fill.
I was so upset, actually, last episode, because they've evaporated into the ether, the mullets in WWF.
But if there's one category we can say WCW overachieved on this night...
Well, I mean...
Mullet of the night.
I mean... So you've got Nick Patrick. Oh, we talked about his counting. We didn't talk about his hair. Fearsome. You've got the total mullet, Lex Luger, who's still knocking around. But winner has to go to Greasy Magnificence, Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah, I thought that'd be it.
Absolutely wonderful.
What about Scott Norton?
Oh, I didn't even mention that. Norton, Benoit. I mean, you've got other people knocking around here who are mulleted.
It's good how you've come to life again, Adam.
There's choice, you know. This pay-per-view was amazing. In terms of its haircuts.
And on that bombshell, it's time to wrap up today's episode. But before we go, if you've enjoyed what you've listened to today, here are the top five ways you can support the show.
Five.
Give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/NewGenerationProjectPodcast, a follow on Twitter at NewGenPodcast, or on Instagram at NewGenPodcast, and interact with us.
Four.
Leave us a five-star review and some kind words on iTunes. A lot of new ones appearing in the last couple of weeks, including a rather nice one from Canada. So if you wrote that, thank you very much.
Nice. No, it wasn't me. Three.
Take a look at our back catalogue that's going up one by one on botchamania.com, including video episodes.
Two.
Check out some of the absolutely free bonus content that we post regularly over at soundcloud.com/newgenpodcast, featuring matches from the WWE, NXT, Chikara, Michinoku Pro and All Japan Pro Wrestling. Our WrestleMania 33 review is posted exclusively there.
And number one.
And if you don't mind giving a little something back, you can pledge to us over at patreon.com/newgenpodcast, where there are some cool rewards for the different levels of donation, and we're working on even more ways of giving thanks in the future. Episode 84 will see us wrap up our journey through perhaps one of the most important years in American professional wrestling, 1997. It's been a long journey.
It has. A lot's happened. I think it's an incredibly different landscape from the start of the year to the end of the year.
Hmm. As we started the year by discussing a WWF television programme, Shotgun Saturday Night, do you remember that?
Yeah, really enjoyable.
Didn't we cover that about 2 years ago?
About 15 months, yeah. It feels only fitting that we close the year by looking at some weekly programming. So, for this episode, it will be the December 29th episode of Raw is War.
Okay.
So there you go. Let's see how the WWF close out their calendar year. See if things have improved slightly since D-Generation X.
Well, we can only hope.
And see where we're going on the road to the Royal Rumble.
And the road in the Gang Wars.
Obviously. Yeah. There is one of those matches on it. I'm sorry. My name is Stuart Brooks. I shall say goodbye.
I'm Adam Wipes. Goodbye.
Yes, Paul Screens. I'm hoping to be in a better mood next time. Bye. Bye.